Good morning. The Board of Supervisors is now in session. Would everyone please rise and join me in the flag salute? And may we have any changes to the agenda, please?
You have a couple of changes to today's agenda. Under the consent agenda, item B25 is a request from the Board of Supervisors to approve letters supporting the public protection of Peter's Bonkus property. All districts recommend approval and instruct the chairperson to sign. Staff is requesting that this item be amended by adding several pages that were inadvertently left out of the staff report. Under closed session, under added items, under pending litigation, we have number 9, Capuano versus California Coastal Commission et al., number 10, County of San Luis Obispo versus Rowan, number 11, Santa Margarita Area Residents Together versus the County of San Luis Obispo, and number 12, Santa Maria Water Conservation District versus City of Santa Maria. All requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirements, and that's your changes for today.
Oh, thank you very much. That brings us to the presentation calendar.
Second.
May we have a roll call, please?
Thank you. Mr. Ovitt?
Aye.
Mr. Shajian?
Aye.
Mr. Linthal?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes. Would James Ira please come to the podium?
Peter.
Thank you.
Good morning, Steve Bolts from the Office of the Sheriff Coroner. Jim Irie couldn't be here today, but I will be here to present some plaques to the other two recipients.
Okay, would you like to take his resolution to him? I think I would like to read it anyway.
Yes, could you read it into the record, and then I'll take it for him. Thanks.
Okay. Whereas for over 30 years, Jim Irie has benefited the public through law enforcement service, and whereas he was hired as a deputy sheriff by the County of San Luis Obispo on December 2, 1974, and retired on July 30, 2005, and whereas he has worked patrol, custody, and civil divisions, and whereas the sheriff's department has profited by his abilities in all its various divisions, now, therefore, the Board of Supervisors of the County of San Luis Obispo, State of California, commends Jim Irie for his exemplary service record and expresses the county's appreciation for his many years of service. And if you would come forward and get the resolution, please. Did you wish to make some comments or not?
Yeah, Jim, unfortunately for us, retired and left us and hasn't even answered his phone for the last 2 weeks, so we haven't been able to get him in there. I'm sure that he's taking a long-deserved and well-deserved vacation. But Jim, most folks in the courthouse will remember him over the last 20 years at least for his service in our civil division and our civil enforcement bureau.
Okay, thank you very much. The next person is Charles Gassett. And that's you? Okay. Mr. Linthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a real pleasure to read this, not only to congratulate somebody on their 30-year career in law enforcement, but to congratulate a friend that I've known for 30 years, so I take some personal pride, I guess, in reading the following resolution. Whereas for over 30 years, Chuck Gassett has benefited the public through law enforcement service, and whereas he was hired as a deputy sheriff by the County of San Luis Obispo on December 30th, 1974, and, excuse me, will retire on September 9th, 2005, which is, I think, just around the corner, right, Chuck?
Yes.
Also, whereas he has worked patrol and civil divisions, and whereas the Sheriff's Department has profited by his abilities in all various divisions, Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors of the County of San Luis Obispo, State of California, commends Chuck Gassett for his exemplary service record and express the county's appreciation for his many years of service. And I just want to thank him for his many years of friendship. Chuck, it was a pleasure.
I just want to thank everybody from the Board of Supervisors and administration of the Sheriff's Department for allowing me to work here for the last 30 years. It's been a pleasure, and thank you very much.
Hold on a second, Chuck. I get the last word. Last week, Chuck was represented for, or was acknowledged for his 30 years of service, and our timing was a little bit off, so we had to have him come back here and drag him in for another presentation. I promised him I wouldn't tell all the stories, but I did say one now. Relax, Chuck. I'm not going to do that to you. I do have a plaque to present you on behalf of Sheriff Hedges and the department. It will read when it's finalized. San Luis Obispo County Sheriff's Department presented to Chuck Gassett in recognition of your 30 years of loyal service and dedication to the citizens of San Luis Obispo County. Thank you, Chuck.
Say thank you once more, and I hope this is the last time we have to finish. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We'll see you next week.
Mr. Shajan.
Thank you. At this time, if Pete will come forward, please. While Pete is coming forward, I'll go ahead and read the resolution. Whereas Pete Bayer began his career in 1980 as correctional officer and retired on July 9, 2005. And whereas in 1981, Pete was promoted to deputy sheriff and worked all three patrol stations and was specifically chosen to work a foot patrol during the summer months at Avila Beach. And whereas in November 1989, Pete was assigned to the detective division working in the sexual assault unit, where he was widely regarded as sexual assault investigator for both his compassion and investigative abilities, and worked the coroner unit where he eventually became the chief deputy coroner. And whereas he was promoted to the rank of sergeant in May of 1994 and remained in the detective division supervising the coroner and sexual assault units and also directed and supervised many complex investigations, including homicides. And whereas in September of 2003, Pete was transferred to the special operations unit, being responsible for the daily operation and supervision of the gang task force, special problems unit, and the narcotic unit. Now, therefore, the Board of Supervisors of the County of San Luis Obispo, State of California, commends Pete Bayer for his exemplary service record and expresses the county's appreciation for his many years of service. Pete, thank you. If you come forward and accept this resolution on our behalf, please.
Pete was asked to return here again today, and I want to say a couple things about Pete. All three of the employees that are retiring, either have retired or will retire, are well known in the department for their special expertise. Pete, in particular, when he was in the coroner's unit, worked very hard to automate the record system and the database for coroners, and bring us into the 21st century. So for that and many other accomplishments that Pete has made and created for the department, I'd like to present him with this plaque from the department. San Luis Obispo County Sheriff's Department presented to Pete Bayer in recognition of your 25 years of loyal service and dedication to the citizens of San Luis Obispo County, 1980 to 2005. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes our presentation calendar. And now is the time for public comment, and this is for any item that is not on the agenda for the day and over which we have some control. So the first speaker is Catherine Manning, and the second is Michael Wynn.
Good morning. It's nice to be here in your new facility. This is my first visit here. My name is Catherine Manning, and I'm here today on behalf of Agape Church, known also as Agape Christian Fellowship in the community. And I just wanted to personally come and invite each of you and the staff that has been involved in the process of helping us to have our new facility. We're inviting you. You received an invitation. I have an extra one here for you as well in case it got shuffled in some papers, as I know a lot of mail can. And to invite you to come and celebrate with us at our new facility as well. We have had a couple of services, but we are having a dedication service this Sunday, August 28th at 1 o'clock. It will be an open house to see our new church facility. Some of it is still in process, but a large portion is done. And there'll be a dedication service at 2 o'clock. And we just invite you to come. Some of you are new on the board, and we're not involved in our eight-year process of getting this work completed. But we're very excited, as I'm sure you are, to be in your new facility. And we invite you to come and celebrate with us. And I'm just inviting you on behalf of the pastors and the church congregation. So thank you very much.
And thank you for your comments. Michael Wynn, followed by Eric Greening.
Madam Chair and members of the board, I'm speaking to you today as the chairman of the Water Resources Advisory Council.
And you can move that microphone up closer and you can hear you better.
Is that better?
That's better.
The RAC is your longest-lived advisory committee in this county, and it represents all of the incorporated cities, the community service districts. Each of you appoint one representative from your district. There includes water companies and other interests, including agriculture and environmental interests. We held a special meeting last Wednesday because, as you know, the Bureau of Reclamation put out a draft EIR about a pipeline designed to go through our county and to eventually dump selenium-enriched water into the Pacific Ocean. We felt this was a very important issue. The RAC found that the DAEIR is seriously defective. It does not deal with seismic issues. There's no revenue stream for its maintenance or inspection. And, of course, the question is what impacts it would have on all the land that it goes through was unanswered. We voted unanimously to support your position, which you voted on several years ago. We would urge you to do whatever you can to reaffirm that so that the powers that be don't believe that you've lost interest or changed your mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric Greening, followed by David Dugan. Duggan?
I'm Eric Greening, and I'm a member of the RAC, the Water Resources Advisory Committee. When I say RAC, people think medieval torture device, but it usually isn't. Usually we have very nice discussions. We did indeed take the trouble to call a special meeting in the middle of the summer because we took this threat very seriously, and we did indeed pass the following motion unanimously. The RAC endorses the supervisor's strong position in opposition to the ocean disposal alternative and endorses staff's list of insufficiencies in the DEIS. Further, RAC encourages member agencies and individuals to send comments to the Bureau of Reclamation. We had understood that you would have a consent agenda item today that would actually provide a way for you to reaffirm the position you took in 2002 and renew it in the light of present circumstances. You still can act as individuals, and I hope that you all do speak out on this. Physically, that alternative was so absurd that we thought it had disappeared and wouldn't be seriously concerned again. It reappeared because even though physically absurd, it may look politically feasible. There are far more people, far more legislators representing the Central Valley and the Bay Area than there are here. It may be thought that we would be the weak link, and that's why it is so important for us to stand together, because it may make political sense to use our ocean as the valley's toxic waste dump, but it makes no physical sense, and it's totally irresponsible. And indeed, the terrestrial impacts of the pipeline are also a very great concern. It would be a threat to each of the 102 blue line streams it crosses. There is nothing in the EIS to describe the pressures inside that pipe. If it was gravity flow, they would be high. As Mike Wynn said, unlike the state water pipeline, which poses a similar threat with chlorinated water, there is no revenue stream from a product here that people are paying for to assure continued maintenance. The EIS is trying to have it both ways. They want to assure us that we won't notice it once it's in place, and yet how can we be assured that it will be maintained if there's nothing noticeable where it's in place? The state water pipeline surprised us with these ancillary structures that weren't even in the initial EIR, and that EIR was much more thorough than this EIS in outlining this alternative. So please do all you can to stand up and make sure the Bureau of Reclamation buries this alternative once and for all. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Eric. David Duggan.
David Dugan.
Oh, Dugan.
Resident of Los Osos, citizen of the United States.
Those two G's throw me every time.
Yeah, well, that's the Irish for you. Chairperson Bianchi and board members, civil rights, voting rights, and free and fair election. It's these and other lofty ideals that make this very seat of government possible. So when these rights and freedoms are threatened, are you to turn a blind eye to the assault? Here you sit safe in your position of power and authority while others use their positions of power and authority to silence speech, squash dissenting views, minimize, isolate, and dehumanize any and all opposition. While you sit protected in your position of power and authority, others have plotted to use the very media we now employ to assault and terrorize a community in an effort to sway political will. As you sit smug and absolute in your position of power and authority, gross violation after gross violations are being committed by those in position of power and authority, and you sit and say nothing. Are we to assume you do not see these crimes against our very freedoms being committed? Are we to assume you know nothing of the blatant disregard of the very same rights and protections you are afforded? Are we not guaranteed the right to an unobstructed and unhindered election process? Are we not guaranteed the right to free speech so we may have equal voice to question and petition those who govern us? Are we not guaranteed the right to equal access as to guarantee that dissenting voices shall be heard? How can you sit there so self-assured in your position of governance and authority and allow the blatant use of public resources to sway the electorate through threat and intimidation? Is this not America, or is this Hitler's Germany? Is this not America, or is this Stalin's Soviet Union? Is this not America, or is it Mao's Red China? Is this not America, or is it Saddam Hussein's Iraq? When those who know what price we pay for freedom disregard the very core beliefs of this nation and use their position of power and authority to control the free will of those they govern, they should not be considered enemies from within? When those who govern and trample on the rights of citizens with total disregard for the law, should they not be considered hostile to the people? How can you sit there safe, protected, smug, resolute, and self-assured in your position of power and authority while those who are in position of governance commit social, economic, and political rape of a community? If you do not intervene, does this not make you complicit? Are my words falling on deaf ears? Do I have to petition higher authority? Or will you, with your power of authority, do the right thing and act swiftly? For you see, the world is watching, and we will have justice. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. That was my last request to speak for him. I would like to comment on the EIS, and because it's a federal document, it's an environmental impact statement. And our board took action several years ago to oppose the San Luis drainage, as Mr. Wynn said, and we've already sent letters, and because we have already taken action, we didn't need to redo the action. So our board has sent letters in opposition, And some of our departments have sent letters questioning and expressing the department's concerns about the San Luis drainage. And many individuals who are very well qualified have also reviewed the document and have sent individual letters questioning the EIS and the project. It's really a very bad project, and we need to. And my concern is, I see Mr. Edge leaning forward to make a statement, but my concern is the EIS is so bad that has the Bureau of Reclamation decided that they're not going to come over here, or is it a political decision and they've already decided they will? So that's my personal concern. It does not represent the board at this point. Mr. Edge.
My comment was on a subsequent speaker, Madam Chair. Just on,
yes,
on this one, I think you, Mr. Greenick, had asked, and you pointed out we had a letter that you signed last week, which we sent, and you signed as chair of the board on behalf of the board because it was reflecting a position the board had previously taken, so it didn't need to come back to the board for specific action. And I believe that we are we will be bringing that letter as a consent agenda item for information purposes, I think, in the next agenda.
Well, that's in September.
Yeah, but that's just for information purposes, not for any board action that's needed at this point.
Thank you. With that,
and
we will...
Madam Chair, I also wanted to just mention briefly on Mr. Dugan's comments. Mr. Dugan was making some points in relation to, I believe, the Los Osos CSD and his concerns in relation to what the CSD may or may not be doing with an upcoming election. And it is worth pointing out that the Board of Supervisors was democratically invited to leave Los Osos in 1998 when the local citizens chose to form the CSD. And the Board of Supervisors is not a superior body to an independent community services district. You've had this issue before the board on several occasions since that time with people asking you to, as it were, overrule the CSD, and it's just worth pointing out, the board is aware, but it's worth pointing out for members of the public who may be listening, that the Board of Supervisors is not a superior agency to the CSD in terms of their authority. They're an independent elected body that doesn't report to the Board of Supervisors. Consequently, the actions that I felt Mr. Dugan was requesting that your board take would be actions that you don't have any authority to take in that particular situation.
Thank you for your comments. With that, we will move on to the consent agenda. I have one request to speak form on one item for the consent agenda. And I will open it to the public. And Jan Marks, please.
Thank you. My name is Jan Marks, and I live in the city of San Luis Obispo. Good morning, Chairperson Bianchi and Board of Supervisors. I have been asked to read a letter, which you have already received, on behalf of Sarah Christie, who has to be at work today and cannot attend this meeting. I'm not sure I'll have enough time to read the whole thing, so I'm going to read quickly. Honorable Supervisors, as my work schedule prevents me from attending your 8-23-05 board meeting, I'm submitting this letter for your consideration in lieu of my public testimony on consent item B26. On July 14, 2005, the Planning Commission approved on a vote of 3-1 a vesting tentative tract map to subdivide a parcel for the purpose of creating an 81-unit condominium project at the Gulf Resort Community of Cypress Ridge in Napomo. This project will be a hybrid owner-occupied overnight visitor-serving project wherein the owners are permitted to spend no more than 80 days per year in residence. For the remaining 285 days per year, the units will be rented out as overnight accommodations with the owners and the private association splitting the fees. Skipping ahead a little bit, the project will function primarily as a hotel, and it will be entirely dependent on service workers to attend to the daily needs of the residents. The applicant estimated that the project would create approximately 40 full-time positions, although in reality it would employ more people than that, as not all of the jobs would be full-time. The applicant also stated that most of the workers hired to serve this project would reside in the community of Oceano, which will make the project 100% dependent on commuter workforce. Reading on, I'm going to skip a little bit here. While an inclusionary housing ordinance would make conditions, well, she's asked for employee housing to be made a condition of this project, and she asked for the Planning Commission to continue the item so that that could be considered, and this was rejected on a 3-1 vote. And so Ms. Christie filed her appeal, which she has now withdrawn. She states, as a member of the Planning Commission, I'm cognizant of the county's well-documented need for affordable housing. And she wants me to make sure that everyone understands that her main concern was that the board take advantage of every opportunity to create affordable and employee housing. And that's the reason she filed the appeal. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Charlie Whitney.
Madam Chair, board members, Charlie Whitney, Santa Margarita. What has become known as workforce housing is becoming one of the most difficult and pressing issues facing San Luis Obispo County. It is no secret that those who provide the essential lower wage labor and services so necessary to our community genuinely need Central Coast housing at South Dakota prices. There has been an abundance of publicity and media coverage, as well as numerous government and privately sponsored workshops to address this very issue. However, this agenda item is not about the legitimate issue of affordable housing. However, a high-profile employee of the California Coastal Commission sitting on the Planning Commission already raises in my mind this distinct possibility of a serious conflict of interest. When that individual appeals a decision made by the very commission on which she is a member, I believe it becomes more about the apparent misuse of a well-established public process. This appeal was nothing less than an irresponsible political stunt with the disingenuous intent of inciting class warfare with little or no regard for public treasure. As a member of a local advisory council, I attended the Community Advisory Council chairs meeting last Saturday, at which the planning director informed us that one of the most perplexing problems you, as a board, deal with, are responsible for, is how to prioritize your budget to effectively deal with the many complex planning issues facing county government. The staff report indicates that in excess of $1,500 in time and materials has already been expended on this frivolous appeal. Precedent dictates that the filing fee of $604 not be waived, and I urge you at the very least to follow the staff recommendations in this regard. In the spirit of fiscal responsibility, I would suggest that you account for all staff and board members' time and bill the appellant the appropriate balance due. In closing, I would like to refer you and the appellant to the writings of Lord Acton regarding the corruption of power. Abuse and concentration of power is no laughing matter, something that could surely be taken up by county council and the grand jury at some point in time. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. That was my last request to speak form on the consent agenda. So with that, I will close it to the public and bring it back to the board. Mr. Ovett, do you have any items to pull?
No, Madam Chair.
Mr. Patterson.
B-26, please.
Mr. Lenthal.
No, ma'am.
Mr. Gershadjian.
No, ma'am.
And I have none. So item B-26. Mr. Patterson, is this for comment or separate motion?
Comment.
Okay, thank you.
I want to thank Ms. March for reading Sarah Christie's letter into the record. Sarah was unable to be here this morning because she is working. And I just want to comment regarding the appeal that she filed. She, as I, have some very serious concerns about the availability of workforce and affordable housing in San Luis Obispo County. And we, as a community, have missed several opportunities to include workforce housing and projects that have come before the Planning Commission primarily over the past many months. And in talking with staff, we have taken measures at the staff level, and we do have an adopted housing element, and we are currently working to implement programs within that element to ensure that we improve the housing balance in San Luis Obispo County. And my comment is that planning commissioners, both at the county and city level, provide more effort as a volunteer, I think, than any other category of volunteer in public service. And it's often a thankless job, but yet a very demanding and strategic job for the future of our cities and county. And I very much appreciate the effort that Sarah Christie has put in on the Planning Commission in behalf of the residents of San Luis Obispo County. And, you know, she really was acting out of a concern for a lack of affordable housing in San Luis Obispo County, and that was the purpose of her filing this appeal. Now, as a representative of all the residents of San Luis Obispo County, I do have a responsibility to all of the taxpayers, and I understand that staff has put in a considerable amount of effort on the processing of the appeal, which has subsequently been withdrawn, because in conversations with staff, we are looking at ways to accelerate the implementation of programs to address our housing imbalance in San Luis Obispo County. And it is my hope that in the very near future, this board will schedule a public hearing with our planning and building staff to talk about some of the programs that we have currently adopted in our housing element, and measures to get those programs in place as soon as possible so we can start addressing this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, may we have a motion, please?
Second.
Move consent agenda?
Yes.
And second?
Yes.
Who seconded it?
Mr. Lenthal? Mr. Shahjian made the motion.
May we have a roll call, please?
Mr. Shahjian?
Aye.
Mr. Lenthal?
Aye.
Mr. Ovid?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes. With that, we will move on to item C1, please. I think it's C1.
Item C1 is a hearing to consider an appeal by Thomas and Dory Zwinger of the Planning Commission's decision of the May 12, 2005, to not allow a reconsideration of the conditions of approval for Tract 1678 to adjust the originally approved construction control line and building envelope for Lot 1 of Tract 1678 to allow the construction of a 1,200-square-foot secondary dwelling over 250 feet from the existing primary dwelling on a 6.5-acre parcel located north of the Lopez Lake, Colitos Road intersection, approximately 3 miles east of the city of Arroyo Grande, in the 4th District. Recommendation is for denial of the appeal and instruct the chairperson to sign.
Thank you. May we have a staff report, please?
Good morning, chairperson, members of the board. Stephanie Fuse, County Planning. As was stated, the item is a reconsiderer. Is it on?
No, not yet.
Okay. Should I wait?
Okay. There.
Okay. The item is a reconsideration of the conditions of approval for Tract 1678 to allow construction of a 1,200-square-foot secondary dwelling outside the originally approved construction control line and building envelope. The project is located on Pioneer Circle off of Corralitos Road.
Is your mic on?
It is. You can't hear me?
Okay, you kind of have to lean forward.
I have to really lean forward. Okay. The project is located on Pioneer Circle off of Corralitos Road and Lopez Drive, east of the city of Arroyo Grande. The project is located in the residential rural land use category. And there's a slide showing the originally approved construction control line with the existing residence and the proposed secondary dwelling location. On May 12th, the Planning Commission had a meeting and denied the request, based on the findings that modification of the building site would be inconsistent with the character and intent of the original map approval. because it would be an incompatible residential density, that there would be no visual buffering between the existing ag and residences, and there would be no buffering from the farm fields adjacent to the property. And there's an aerial photo showing the ag and the property in question. And then there was another slide after that. That's a slide showing the existing residence from Lopez Drive looking northeast.
You really have to speak up.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's a slide showing the residence from Lopez Drive looking northeast. And then I had another slide after that. And that's the site of the proposed secondary. Appeal was filed by the applicant, and the issues and staff's responses are outlined in the board staff report. And with that, staff is recommending denial of the appeal and that the board uphold the Planning Commission's decision to deny the reconsideration of the conditions of approval for Track 1678 based on the findings in Exhibit A. And staff's available for questions at this time.
Are there any questions of staff? Mr. Shadjan, followed by Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did meet both with applicants and the opponents of the project. I have a couple of questions for clarification purposes. I know they're in our staff report, but as they come to speak, they might wish to address the issue too. Now, according to what I have in front of me, the CCNR does allow a secondary dwelling, correct? But it does have an envelope specific.
That's our understanding.
Okay.
There are two other lots in this tract that have secondary dwellings already built.
Now, there's a concern from a neighbor who will hear from Mr. Cacchetti about flooding issues. On C-117, you addressed those issues. Would you tell us about it a little more?
Section 10.
Do you have a picture of this? Can we use this picture?
We can.
Even though I have some notes that I need. Let me see.
When the project originally went to the Planning Commission, staff's recommendation was for approval of the reconsideration, and we had conditioned the project to submit a drainage plan in order to address any drainage concerns that may be included with the construction of this secondary dwelling. The drainage plan would include possible retention basins, any measures that would not increase the historic flows to adjacent properties.
So there will be a retention pond?
Possibly, if the drainage plan.
So in other words, that is a condition if this was to go forward.
That's right.
Okay. And on, as far as this new residence using sewage, would it require leach field? And are there any nearby water wells that will be impacted by this? Or is there a condition that when it went to the Planning Commission was part of it? I think it's on C-140 does.
Right, we did condition that they submit soil boring information, that there's adequate distance between groundwater and the leach fields. And ordinance standards require that any septic tank or leach field be located at least 100 feet from any well or 200 feet from any community well.
Where the site shows, is that within the 100 feet or further or closer?
It's farther away from any drainage swale or creek.
Is the view shed from Lopez Drive or Corralitos Road?
The view shed would be from Lopez Drive.
Lopez Drive.
It's the
and
public
if it road. Was to go on this location, how well would it be seen from Lopez Drive in comparison to where the envelope allows it to be as a secondary dwelling?
It would actually be less visible. Staff's opinion is that it would be less visible because from looking at the slide of the existing house, within the building envelope, it would be visible from both sides, going east or west on Lopez Drive, whereas the location for the proposed secondary dwelling would only be visible briefly traveling west on Lopez Drive. And the applicant did agree to use muted, darker colors and to do some additional landscaping to screen the secondary
on,
further.
On C-116, you do speak of landscaping, unless I missed it. Are there any trees recommended to do to even cover it up a little more than just the
That's
colors
right.
do?
They did propose to do some additional landscape screening.
And the choice for the applicant to go on this side, is it better to build a house on this location than other sites on the property?
It's staff's opinion that within the construction control lines that were originally approved, it would be very visible, and primarily the only locations within the envelope that are flat are already contain the leach fields and septic tank for the existing residents.
Reading through staff's report as it went to the Planning Commission, were these all addressed while the commission was addressing this application?
I believe so.
Well, if you have a couple others, I'll come back later.
Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question of staff. Could you show the overhead again of the site plan? I'm curious to know where the ag operations are currently occurring, because it said that there would be a lack of a buffer. And did the Ag Commissioner's office comment on that? I didn't see it in the packet.
It was a verbal response. I actually talked to staff about it and whether or not buffers would be required, and they said that the proposed secondary was outside any buffering
That's
needs
better.
From their department.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, thank you. Does that conclude staff's comments?
Yes.
Okay. With that, I will open it to the public. This is an appeal, so the appellant has 10 minutes to present your argument, so to speak. And that includes everyone involved in the presentation. So the first request to speak for him I have is from Thomas L. Zwinger. And the second is Curtis Zwinger.
Good morning, supervisors and staff. My name is Thomas Zwinger. I live at 125 Pioneer Circle. I'm here today with my partner, my wife, of 39 years. We are not developers, just homeowners. We do have 6.5 acres and are trying to help our son by building a secondary dwelling on our property for him to live in. When possible today, many parents are trying to do this very same thing. We are happy to say that we found a site on our property that surpasses the county's original objectives. We are limited to this site because of the extreme steepness of our property and the septic system. In July of 2003, we went to county planning when our son was talking about moving here from Lake Tahoe. We found out after we got there that we were going to have to wait an entire year to continue with our plans because we were just a little bit late for the endangered Pismo clarkia flower. The next year, we got a negative report on the Pismo clarkia flower, And then we started our plans again. And we started our plans by contacting a builder who we figured could do a little bit better job of putting this thing together than us. His name is Greg Whitford. He had several meetings with county planning, and they advised him what we should do to proceed. We applied for a reconsideration to tract map 1678 to adjust the original approved construction control line and building envelope for lot number one, per the advice of county planners. Two concerns were easily mitigated with them. We were pleased to receive a negative declaration and recommendation for approval from the SLO Planning Department. We had complied with everything they requested of us and were shocked when we were denied by County Planning Commission. Today, I have two neighbors from our tract that are here. Over there is Aggie Vincent to my left, and behind her is Wayne Dempster. I have another person from our tract that's sick today and she couldn't attend. Another one is on vacation, and another is an absentee landowner that lives in Southern California. Besides these people that are with us for this project, I got 9 other letters from nearby neighbors for a total of 14 different letters. Our son is living here now, and we are asking for your support and approval for this project. Thank you for your consideration, and our representative Fred Glick will be giving our closing statements. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to also try and answer them for you.
Are there any questions? I see no lights, so apparently not.
Madam Chair, just to surprise you here, I'm sorry. The conditions that went forward to the Planning Commission when this was a hearing in front of the Planning Commission, when the staff was supporting it, did you have any problems with the conditions that were set forward?
Everything that all the conditions were basically answered in staff's own report. There really weren't any problems between us and staff, the county. Nothing at all.
Okay. I just want to hear you say that because there are quite a few conditions that after spending some time with planning staff and after having heard one of your neighbors' opposition as how it was addressed and if you had agreed to it, that means they will be addressed by both the applicant and our staff will be working if this was to go forward in the future.
There were two, there were two problems. One of them that we mitigated was the drainage plan, and the second was the erosion plan, which we agreed to do.
Okay. Thank you. That answers my question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Curtis Swinger, followed by Fred Glick.
Good morning. My name is Curtis Lee Swinger, and I'd just like to, I appreciate you guys reconsidering the appeal so that my parents can possibly provide some housing for me for a decent price in Slo County. And I'm a small business owner trying to make it here and provide for the county and myself. And I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Mr. Glick, you requested to speak last. I had two other requests to speak forms come in. Do you still want to speak last?
Yes. Yes, I would, ma'am.
Okay. You may sit down.
Thank you.
Mr. George Cicchetti, followed by John Belcher. You have 3 minutes, please.
To the Board of Supervisors. My name is George Cicchetti.
I represent my mother, Elsie Cicchetti, and the Cicchetti family. In the late 1980s, the said property and the issue was sold by the Cicchetti family to McCaney Realty and Development. At the time, there were conditions and restrictions set by the county, the planning department, the CC&R, and the Board of Supervisors. When the Zwingers bought their parcel, they knew these conditions and restrictions, accepted them, and built their home. Now the Zwingers want to change the conditions and restrictions so that they can add a new building, envelope and construction line, separate from the existing building envelope and construction line on the same parcel. The site they are proposing to build this second home on would impact the Cicchetti property with added water runoff. It also raises questions about their sewer and the effects on the swell and the fish and game blue line stream within 100 feet of the proposed secondary home. The Zwingers already brought this matter before the County Planning Commission, and it was rejected 5-0, citing many concerns. If this is approved by the Board of Supervisors after the Planning Commission voted 5-0 against it, then there is no reason to have the Planning Department, the Planning Commission, or the CC&R. So let's just go back to the 1980s, I mean, excuse me, the 1800s, so we can do what we want, build where we want, and save the money that the taxpayers are paying. By not having all of these county departments, we wouldn't even need the Board of Supervisors if we went back to the 1800s. Thank you very much for your time.
And thank you for your comments. John Belcher, followed by Mr. Glick.
Good morning, members of the Board of Supervisors, and I'm sure there would have been a need in the 1880s for the Board of Supervisors no matter what. But in this case, I think that the Planning Commission did a very thorough job with respect to this project. They considered many arguments. Unfortunately, there are no minutes that I've been able to find in your staff report, nor are any of the exhibits that I presented at the Planning Commission submitted in your package. So I'm forced to kind of start from ground zero with the nature of the problem. And I'd like to place a couple exhibits on the overhead and then pass out some photographs that sort of show the circumstances here, if I might.
Yes, you might.
It's already up there.
It was.
Did you touch something on there, Joe? Don't touch the buttons.
See the.
I'll give you an extra few seconds for technical difficulties.
Thank you. And I assume this mic is live?
Yeah.
You can hear it. Yes.
Push the bottom, John.
Is the mic live now?
More trouble.
It was till you touched it. Stephanie, pour some water on it.
Test? Okay. Yes. I want to note the track map that was approved in 1990. This was called a building control line, if you'll notice. And this building control line, construction control line is the label, was put in place to preserve a lot of very fine open space, mostly oaks and other native vegetation, and steep. The density of the project was approved with a waiver of density because it did not meet the slope test. So instead of requiring 10-acre parcels under the zoning ordinance, everybody got down to 6 acres. So there was a density bonus built into this project. And the trade-off was that we were going to keep this open space along this very scenic Coralitas Road. This house is proposed right smack in the middle of that open space area, so that all the travelers on Coralitas Road now are going to get to view this house as they turn and go up the canyon. All the properties had building envelopes, and these are designated on the map. These are attached to CC&Rs, also conditions of approval. There is room for secondary dwelling units on each of these, including the property in question. They claim it's a hardship because they have a septic tank in one of the flat areas. Of course, septic tanks can be relocated. But perhaps the bigger reason is they'd rather have this secondary dwelling some distance from the primary house, and that's an understandable goal, but it wasn't consistent with the subdivision map that was originally approved. As noted, there already are a couple of secondary dwelling units in the project within the building envelopes and above. You'll notice the word above the construction control line. That's the term that's used for the approval. The second graphic I wanted to show you is the topographic map that's attached to the staff report for Tract 1678. That's the project that was approved. I've drawn a line on the swale that runs immediately adjacent to this proposed building site on Parcel 1. You'll see the 1. That's the parcel we're dealing with. Here's the house site up here on the top of the hill. Here's Coralitas. And here is the location. I'm going to mark with an X approximately right here where this second house is. Now, staff has said that the house is located more than 100 feet from a swale and from the Blue Line stream, which runs actually immediately adjacent to Coralitas. But by our measurements, that can't possibly be the case. I'm going to pass around some photographs, I think, that illustrate this.
Mr. Belcher, you are out of time, and I gave you an extra minute for technical difficulties.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll pass out these photographs, which are marked to show the swale and the apparent location of the house.
You can pass those out, but you can stop talking at the same time. So thank you very much for your comments.
I thought you mentioned that my minute was up.
Okay. Mr. Glick, you're next, and ordinarily in an appeal, we give the appellant the right to rebut, but since you are speaking last, you may take 4 minutes and you will have that time.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, members of the board, my name is Fred Glick. I represent the Zwingers. At first, when they first came to talk to me, I was wondering why they needed an attorney. It was when I watched the tape of the Planning Commission that I decided they probably should be represented. Mr. Belcher is a very skilled attorney. I have the utmost respect for him. At the Planning Commission, as well as here, he's raised some issues that I think are simply red herrings. With respect to the drainage issues, I believe that the Department of Public Works has looked at that in detail in terms of that building site. More importantly, that issue will be taken up once again, assuming that they go in, they pass this hurdle, and they go in for a building permit. They're going to have to go through, again, another set of hurdles in order to get that building permit issued. I've looked at the topo map. Some of the issues raised were concerning about the level of the building site as opposed to Lopez Drive. I think the topo maps are very clear in showing that the site is elevated above Lopez Drive. I also believe that the drainage basin that he's talking about, where the swale leads down from, is very minor in comparison to the drainage basin that Blue Line Creek comes down for Coralitas Canyon. Now, the septic and leach lines were brought up in the Planning Commission, and they were brought up here as well. There was a 2004 report done on the site, the proposed site. And the result of that report indicates that the soils there had relatively quick percolation. Now, that's different from the site that the existing construction control line is now where the primary house is located. That percolation was very poor. Therefore, the septic system in the leach field is larger than normal. And the only other remaining area that you could consider for a structure is way too steep for a structure and has immensely proportionally large view problems. Moving on, archaeology, that was raised at the Planning Commission. That report was done by Dr. Dill in 1989, and his conclusions were no evidence of cultural materials found on the property. That's the entire project site. I think nothing has happened in the 15 years since that report that would require further study of that site. The impact view, as you heard staff say, this provides a better site with regards to those particular considerations. There's a very limited view from Lopez Drive that can be easily screened to take care of that problem. Now, just as a general overview, the Zingers started this process a long time ago. And if you look at the site, you'll realize no matter what size house they had built on that primary site with the construction control line, they weren't going to be able to do a secondary house or secondary dwelling. It just was physically impossible. So they studied the proposed site. They didn't just haphazardly pick this site. They went to a contractor. They did the studies. They went to the planning staff and looked for any red flag indications that this couldn't be done. They were encouraged by planning staff, and ultimately, to abbreviate this, they received staff recommendation for approval of the negative deck, and that's after doing an exhaustive initial study summary. Times have changed, and basically I think the Planning Commission said, we're not going to allow this because, you know, you made your bargain 15 years ago. That's it. Thank you.
And that's it. Thank you very much for your comments. With that, I will close it to the public, bring it back to the board for discussion and or action.
Madam Chair, I would like to ask the staff if they can respond to the issues being brought forward for the Blue Line existence. Mr. Belcher made a point or two. Would you respond to that?
From our measurements and in doing the initial study, the proposed location of the secondary dwelling was about 175 feet from the creek along Chlorolitos.
Is there a minimum requirement?
100 feet.
Now, does Fish and Game has anything to say about this?
Generally, their requirements are to stay at least 100 feet away from the creek.
Thank you.
Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question of staff. One of the speakers raised the issue of flooding, and it is my understanding that if this project moves forward, it would be conditioned as was outlined in the presentation to the Planning Commission, and that it could not exacerbate flooding conditions. The construction of the house could not be allowed to exacerbate current flooding conditions. All water would have to be contained on site or mitigated in some other way. Is that correct?
That's correct. They would have to demonstrate that the construction of this building would not increase historic flows. They'd be allowed to continue whatever historic flows were going across the property, but not increase the flow that would go off site.
And that would actually occur before that analysis would occur before a permit is issued?
That would be part of the drainage plan review.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I have no other speakers.
Okay, with that, Madam Chair, I recently met the Swingers and talked about their plan, and I know Mr. Chiquetti for much, much longer, so I know he has legit concerns, but having gone over the conditions time over time with staff, I don't want to disappoint him. It's always difficult to disappoint a friend, but I'm going to go ahead and move approval to uphold the appeal.
Second.
May we have a roll call, please?
Mr. Shajian?
Aye.
Mr. Linthal?
Aye.
Mr. Ovid?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if we have a resolution for approval?
Yeah, there was.
Thank you.
No, the resolution there was for denial.
Was it for approval?
Mm-mm.
Oh, my mistake.
So we have to make a tentative to bring it back?
Motion. Can we bring it back? Just make a tentative and bring it back?
Bring it back.
We could bring it back later
this afternoon.
This afternoon?
Tell us
okay.
What time.
So you're amending your motion to make it tentative?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank
bring
you.
It back 2 o'clock?
2 o'clock?
Madam Chair, may I ask the motion maker a question?
Sure. Yes, you may.
Warren Hogue, Department of Planning and Building. I'm assuming that you would like the resolution to reflect the findings and conditions that were in the original staff report to the Planning Commission?
Correct.
Is there anything additional you would like us to address?
No, and Mr. Vogel, luckily it was you that I discussed this issue yesterday, and I think all my questions or my concerns that came forward from Mr. Cicchetti, you responded, and they were all addressed within the conditions that went when it did go to Planning Commission. And as I asked Mr. Swinger here today, he doesn't have any problems addressing those conditions and or mitigation. So yeah, my motion will include that.
Thank you.
Mr. Shajan, I see questioning looks on the faces of the swingers. Would you explain the motion?
Okay, the motion is your application will go forward, but we'll finalize it this afternoon at 2 o'clock because staff has to bring forward a resolution upholding your appeal. That means your appeal did go through to your satisfaction.
Okay,
does
thank
that
you.
Answer your question? But if you have any further questions, you're welcome to call us or the Madam Clerk, and you don't have to be here at 2 o'clock, no.
Okay.
Be advisable.
Thank you. With that, I'm wondering, we have our clerk recorder here, approximately how long will your issue take?
Probably my report will be 15.
Okay, we'll go ahead then with item E1 and take our break after that at 10:30.
Item E1 is reporting on a voting system solutions to implement accessibility requirements of the Help America Vote Act. Sorry, that one got.
Thank you. And may we have a staff report, please? I don't think you're. The green light has to
there.
Be on.
Okay.
And you have to lean forward.
Yeah. I apologize. It's just going to take me a moment to get my presentation up. It was working this morning.
Belcher blew it.
That must be what it is, huh? No, it's actually on my USB drive. I have it on a CD. I'm here to report to you on what we do with technology in the office, and this is my first PowerPoint presentation, so I apologize for fumbling around.
Did you say fumbling?
Did I say fumble? Yeah. Actually, I wanted to title it Report on Voting System Solution or How I Spent My Summer Vacation, because we've certainly been spending a lot of time in our office studying the solutions that are presented to us. But I want to walk you through that system now. Can you hear me if I speak from this? Just to give you some background, the Help America Vote Act was passed by Congress in 2002, and it mandates several things, including uniform requirements for federal elections, accessible voting systems that provide the same access and participation to disabled individuals as to other voters, including privacy and independence. If the county chooses, instead of having a fully accessible system, they can choose to have one accessible voting machine at every polling place. And these voting systems must be compliant by January 1st of 2006. As with any state or federal mandate, one of the first questions that comes up is how are we going to pay for this? And that's one of the good things about this mandate. We have several sources of money. The Voting Modernization Bond Act was passed by voters in 2002. Our share of that fund is $1.3 million. It requires the county to pay one quarter of the cost of the voting system purchase. The money can only be used for the purchase of voting systems, hardware, and software. And the deadline for funding approval is quickly approaching, is December 31st of 2005. The Help America Vote Act, in addition, has also given the state and county money. Our share of that is $1.69 million,
and it can be used to pay for the county share, which is required by the voting modernization bond. So we can purchase a voting system at no cost to the county. It can also be used for one-time expenses not allowed under the VMB funding. So what are our options available to us right now? The first option that we looked at was to supplement our existing optical scan system with one DRE, commonly known as a touchscreen, at every polling place. What this looks like to the voters is that most voters would continue to vote on the optical scan ballot that they're used to seeing right now. Those ballots would be counted on our precinct-based optical scan unit. Disabled voters would use a DRE with the audio component and the keypad if they desired. Their ballot would be cast directly on the DRE after the voter-verified paper trail is printed. And then the vote totals from the two machines are transmitted or brought to our office separately after the close of polls.
Mr. Allwell, Madam Chair, should we ask questions as she's going forward, or you rather us wait till the end?
It's up to you. I can proceed and then go along,
because then the questions are fresh.
Okay.
Would you go over the disabled function again? Because I did receive some literature that said that this did not serve the would not be a service to our disabled voters.
Actually, I think what you're talking about, I don't know if you're talking about the DREs, or are you talking about the AutoMark system, which is our next option?
Why don't you tell us the difference and,
okay.
And educate us on all of it.
A DRE is essentially a direct recording device. I don't have a picture of it, I'm sorry, but it's a touchscreen device that has an audio component, so there would be headphones and a keypad, and a disabled voter would move through the ballot, a visually impaired voter, for instance, would move through the ballot using the keypad. Listening to the audio ballot and then making their selections based on the options given them. Press 5 to vote for this candidate, press 7 to move to the next candidate, like that. It can also be used by people that find it difficult to mark an optical scan ballot because they merely need to touch the computer screen to cast their ballots. So that's how the DRE works. The other solution that I'll be presenting to you is called an AutoMark. It actually accepts the optical scan ballot, but functions much like a touch screen. So once it accepts the optical scan ballot, it's displayed on the screen. A visually impaired voter uses the audio and a keypad. The AutoMark also comes with the capability of a foot pad if you have hand mobility issues. And a sip and puff device so that those voters who don't have use of their hands at all can use a sip and puff device to cast their ballots. Once the voter makes their choices and okays those choices, the AutoMark actually marks the ballot. So it marks the optical scan ballot, and then that ballot is ejected and taken to the optical scan unit and counted just like any of our other ballots. Those are basically the two options that are available to meeting the accessibility requirements of the Help America Vote Act. So does that answer your question to this extent? And then when we get into the other proposals, we can talk more. The cost of this system is approximately $968,000 to supplement our existing system with a DRE, and it's fully funded by state. It would be fully funded by state and federal funds.
Is there a time on that as how soon they'll refund or?
The voting modernization bond, once we get the approval through them, we have to expend the money and then we send them the invoices and they reimburse us. We haven't gotten the funding mechanism yet for the Help America Vote Act funds, but I would assume it will be the same. They will reimburse us based on a paid invoice. And most of the counties that have already implemented systems are reporting that they're getting that funding within a couple of months. So there's not a delay. What are the advantages of this system or this option? Most voters will use the system that they are familiar with. Staff and poll workers are familiar with our current optical scan system, and it's the least expensive option. Disadvantages. There are additional responsibilities and training for our poll workers because they'll basically have to operate the DREs and two different systems at the polls, so they'll be having additional responsibilities. As you all know, there's been negative attention which has been focused on the DREs, and we're not sure that our voters feel confident in the systems. It could compromise the confidentiality of the votes if only one or two voters at a polling place use the DRE, which could be true in some of our more rural polls. The status and use of the state-required voter-verified paper trail is still being debated. There's current legislation that would require that the paper trail actually be the ballot that's used in a recount or in our 1% manual tally, which just further complicates the certification process. There would be increased staff time for testing and ballot layout, and currently the Diebold TSX is not certified for use in California, although they are actively pursuing certification. Option two would be to replace the system with the ESNS optical scan system with one auto-mark device, which is what I was describing to Supervisor Ashajian. System description, all voters would vote on the same optical scan ballot. Disabled voters would use the auto-mark, which is just a ballot marking device. They can use the touchscreen or the audio with the keypad or footpad. Once the ballot is cast, the auto-mark marks the ballot, and the ballot is ejected and fed through the optical scan unit, the same one that's used by all the other voters. Also, all ballots would be counted on that optical scan unit, and the ballots would be transmitted after the close of polls, just like they're being done currently. The cost of this is approximately $1.3 million, and again, would be fully funded from our state and federal funds. Oops. Advantages to this option, we would have a single vote tabulation in the county. We would be replacing older system with new technology. The auto mark clearly captures the voter intent. That's one of the controversies with the DRE, is capturing voter intent and how you know that it's really capturing it. The auto mark accommodates the widest range of disabilities. As I said, it allows a sip and puff device to be attached. The auto mark was favorably received in a San Luis Obispo test that we did with some of our visually impaired voters and our poll workers. And the auto mark was recently certified by the Secretary of State. Disadvantages: election staff will have to learn an entirely new system. We've been using the Diebold system for about 6 years now and are very self-sufficient and very used to the system, so we'd be learning an entirely new system. The auto-mark device weighs 39 pounds, so it's very heavy, difficult for our poll workers to set up, so we'd have to make allowances for our delivery company to set that device up. Marking the ballot can take up to 5 minutes, depending on how many contests there are, so it's going to take longer when we have a longer ballot. There's a concern about the secrecy of the vote if the voter needs assistance removing the ballot. Right now, you have to pull fairly snugly or tightly to get the ballot out of the auto mark. They are trying to address that with the use of a secrecy sleeve. They're also proposing, ESNS is also proposing having a blank ballot stock that would be have all the timing marks and everything except the candidates and that information printed on the ballot, so that the ballot could be marked just like any other optical scan ballot, but you couldn't see actually how it was marked. Now, obviously, a voter cannot look at that ballot and say, yes, this is exactly how I cast my ballot, but it eliminates the concern for the secrecy of their ballot. So they're looking at several options to address that. There would be additional testing and ballot setup, and we will need to dispose of our existing equipment. The third option is to replace our current system with all DREs at polling places. What this would look like is that all poll voters would cast their ballot directly on a DRE. Disabled voters can use the audio and keypad if they wish, or just use the touchscreen. Voter reviews the ballot, and the machine prints a paper trail, and then the votes are added to the electronic tally once cast, and then at the end of the night, all those ballot totals are transmitted to our office. The cost of this is approximately $3.3 million. $2.9 million would be paid from the state and federal funds, so there would be costs to the county with this option. The advantages of these are DREs have several specific advantages. Number one, they notify the voter of unvoted or undervoted contests, something that the optical scan system does not do. Voters can change their vote without requesting a new ballot. Once they review their ballot, they can merely go back and change their vote. All poll voters would use the same technology. DREs can accommodate multiple languages. In San Luis County right now, we do not have a language requirement, but after the 2010 census, I would bet pretty assuredly that we are going to have to print ballot material in at least Spanish. And it would eliminate the cost of $45,000 per election in ballot printing costs. Disadvantages. Again, the negative attention that's focused on the DREs and voters feeling comfortable with the system. It's the highest capital investment of all the options. We have the challenge of transporting the 700 DREs to the various polling places. Recruiting poll workers would be more difficult because we're asking them to learn this rather complicated technology. Status of the state-required voter-verified paper trail is still being debated, as I've discussed before. There would be a separate voting system for absentee voters who are now comprising almost 45% of our voters casting ballots. So that, as that number continues to increase, it would reduce the cost savings that we have on printing poll ballots. Higher voter turnout could result in long lines. I think all of you read reports from various areas in Ohio where there were only a couple of DREs in the long lines, and people have to wait for the DREs to be vacant in order to vote. There would be increased staff time for logistics and testing, increased staff time for ballot layout and proofing of the audio ballots. An extensive voter education campaign would be needed. Our warehouse would need major modifications, and there's no DRE system that's currently certified in California for use in the primary election. Option four is to take no action. This has been tempting, to be honest with you, because it's changing out a voting system is a major undertaking, but it's certainly not one that we're recommending. Advantages to this would be that their guidelines for the HAVA compliance would be complete. They are currently not completed, and a better solution may present itself in the next 6 months. Disadvantages would be we would lose the $1.3 million in state funding, and we would almost certainly invite lawsuits from either the federal government or disabled advocacy groups.
Now, if you take this in to save the money and later on you find out some better solutions or applies to the system, would that be applicable for your, since you bought it earlier? In other words, anything that comes through within the next 6 months that's an advantage to either apply, would you be able to apply it to this machine or equipment?
The $1.3 million?
No, that's a disadvantage if you don't do it now. Let's say you did it to take advantage of $1.3 million.
Right.
If you go up to the advantages, they say a better solution may present itself within the next 6 months. And are we losing that if we move ahead of time?
It's a possibility. We don't see any. The way that the certification works, and some of this, the better solution may present itself is kind of a hope for all of us elections officials. Something will come out, tomorrow that's going to be a better solution. But frankly, it's got to go through federal certification. It's got to go through state certification, which it can't start until it's completed its federal certification. I don't see that happening in time for us to meet the HAVA deadline, which is January 1st of 2006. So basically what we would be saying is that we're not going to take any action, and we're going to kind of put ourselves at the mercy of the federal government wanting to come into San Luis Obispo County and say you haven't taken the steps to be HAVA compliant. Will a better solution come up? I don't think the chances are really good that it'll happen because of the certification process, but I can't say for sure that it won't. Yes.
I was going to ask you if that completed your report.
No.
Go ahead.
Would you like me to?
No.
Okay.
Go ahead.
People
never say when they're finished.
I know. I was going to actually propose a solution here. There will be a conclusion. Our proposal, we've done a tremendous amount of studying in voting systems, and to be frank, we did not look seriously at option three, which was to replace all DREs in our county. There's been considerable negative press about the DREs. I think our voters are pleased with the optical scan system. We have almost half of our voters voting on absentee, so you lose a lot of the advantages that a DRE. So basically, we focus our attention on, do we want to supplement our existing system with a DRE, or do we want to go out and purchase a whole new voting system with this other component called the auto mark, which does not actually count ballots. And so what we're proposing is option number two, which is to purchase the S&S optical scan system with the auto mark. And the reasons for that are the voters are familiar with the optical scan. To them, it's going to be almost seamless. The ballot looks a little bit different, but not tremendously different. Voters may lack confidence in the DREs. The auto mark does not tally or store votes, and that's one of the biggest complaints about the DRE, is that it's tallying, storing those votes, and it could well be manipulated in some ways. The paper audit trail is very clear. I talk to a lot of voters who, you know, want to make sure that we have a paper audit trail in our system, and when I say we vote on paper ballots, that calms their fears about not having an audit trail. We'd be using a single voting system throughout the county. We'd be replacing the old system with new technology. And the ES&S system brings two improvements to our existing system. One is ballots on demand, so we could actually print ballots if we start running out of ballots on election day or we're running low on absentee ballots. We could actually print them in-house so that they're available for our voters much quicker, and it's much cheaper than printing, having an additional run done through our printers. And a high-speed central count, which will greatly reduce the hours that it takes us to count our absentees. And as those numbers continue to grow, that becomes critical. Not done yet. With any system implementation that's as enormous as this, there are implementation risks. One of the biggest ones is that ES&S system is an unknown system to the county staff. We'd be learning a brand new system. There's a short timeline for implementation. We've got 6 months to the nomination period for the June primary and 10 months to election day, so we've got a lot of work. And in between that time, we also happen to have a statewide election that we have to conduct in November, so that takes out a big chunk of our time in preparation for this. And the June primary is the most complicated election that we conduct. What we've done to address these risks is there have been a lot of reports of voting system problems. A lot of them have been focused on Diebold and the DREs, but ES&S with their optical scan has had its share of problems also. So we've been spending some time studying those reports of those problems to make sure that we can have solutions in place to ensure that that does not happen in San Luis Obispo County. There are currently 11 counties in California who use this system, which gives us a strength in numbers, and there will be many of these counties that will be implementing the auto mark in November so we can build off of their experience. Our purchase agreement would include extensive training for staff to become self-sufficient. This is one of the most important things to me. As I said before, we have not had to have anyone from Diebold on site in our county since March of 2002, and it's a good feeling for our staff to be totally self-sufficient in being able to set up and test and certify our elections without any vendor support. So we would want to reach the same level of self-sufficiency as quickly as possible. And then we're proposing to contract with an experienced project manager to assist with the implementation because we have such a short timeline. Again, that contract would be paid for out of the Help America Vote Act funds, so it would be no cost to the county. The impacts, and these impacts would be the same no matter what system we implemented, because with each system we're bringing on additional technology into the county. We'll need warehouse modifications, new racking systems, and new electrical requirements. Voting equipment delivery will be more expensive. We will have to be working with our delivery company to modify those quotes as to how much it'll cost to deliver the additional equipment. And then we've got the workload impacts. The system implementation obviously will be one time, and we're proposing that we'll bring back a contract to you with an experienced project manager to assist us with that, and we can also have extra help to assist us. The maintenance and testing will be ongoing, election day technical support will be ongoing, and poll worker training will be ongoing. And at this time, I'm not proposing any addition to staff for our office. As we work through an election or two, we'll have a better idea of what kind of impacts this will have on our staff. And then at that time, I'll work with the administrative office in presenting to them the information that they need to approve any additional staffing, if we need additional staffing. And then there will also be increased equipment maintenance costs. For the solution that we're proposing, it'll be about $45,000 per year in the increased maintenance because we're maintaining two machines per polling place instead of just the one machine. I also wanted to bring you up to date on a new development. As I said earlier, there are currently no guidelines from the Election Assistance Commission, which was created by the Help America Vote Act, on what voting systems are HAVA compliant. So vendors and counties and states are basically working in a void on this question. The Secretary of State certification does require vendors to upgrade a system if it's found not to be HAVA compliant after the guidelines are issued, and we'll also include that in our contract with ESNS. And then just late last week on Thursday, we received a letter that was sent to both us and the other counties and the Secretary of State from an attorney representing the American Association of Disabled Persons objecting to the AutoMark use for the reasons that I told you, that it doesn't allow a voter with hand mobility issues to vote privately and independently. In a conference call with the Secretary of State on Friday, they believe that these issues can be addressed, and they would be working towards addressing those. I have not had a chance to talk with our county council about this, but we'll be doing so before we proceed with any of our next steps. Next steps would be to negotiate a contract with ESNS if we can move forward. We're hoping to get that done by September 20th or by the end of September at the latest. Present that contract to your board for approval at the October 4th meeting, and then complete and present a project plan and funding package to the Voting Modernization Board at the November meeting. That way, if there are any problems, we still have the December meeting to be able to meet the funding deadlines. So in conclusion, we've got good news. The Help America Vote Act allows us to more fully meet the needs of our voters with special needs. Bringing on this accessible voting system will allow us to do that for the first time. And full funding is available to counties for one-time costs. But there's also bad news associated with it. There is no perfect solution right now. Time is running out, and all solutions will result in increased ongoing costs and perhaps staffing to the counties with no federal or state funds to pay for those increased costs. But with the information available to us right now, we feel that ESNS is the best solution for our county. That's the end of my presentation.
Are there any questions? Yes, Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to precede my questions with a comment to Ms. Rodewald. I really appreciate the thoroughness of your report and the efforts that you and your staff have made in looking at the alternatives. From your experience, do disabled persons currently have someone to assist them with voting? I mean, they almost have to.
Right. Most of the voters that we're in contact with, we have several visually impaired voters, and then they normally vote an absentee ballot and then have someone assist them. We have in March of 2002 and November of 2002, we did use touch screens in our office with the auto capability, and they actually came into our office and voted on the touch screens at that time. It's a long process for them. I think a lot of voters will come in and try the new technology, and then it'll be up to them whether that privacy and independence is worth the time that it takes coming to the polls, or do they want to continue to vote absentee. They'll still have both options available to them. But this does increase the option, so they don't have to come to our office. They can actually go to their own polling place and have the same technology available to them.
Right. Thank you. The system you use currently, is that HAVA consistent? Just having the option available if they would come to your office or some designated place other than their own polling place, or do we have to upgrade to the point where voters can go to their recommended polling place?
We do have to upgrade. The HAVA says that either you replace your voting system with a voting system that's entirely accessible, which would be basically the DREs, or you place one accessible machine at every polling place. We were fortunate that they said every polling place and not every precinct, because there are several of our polling places that house numerous precincts. So we're able to just provide one at every polling place and not every precinct. So it does reduce the number of machines that we need, but we have to have them in the polling places.
Okay, and What range of disabilities are actually covered with the use of the improved technology? Do we cover basically all range of?
I think it would be virtually impossible to cover every possible disability. I mean, if we talk about someone with that's visually impaired and deaf, it would be very difficult. I mean, using either the DRE or the AutoMark would be impossible because they either have to be able to hear or to see to use the technology. I think that they're trying to work on improvements to the system to make them available for voters with every kind of disability. But at this point, I would say that's not the state of the systems that are available.
But you do make the opportunity available in some form to regard.
Yes, and I would say to most of our voters that the opportunity is available to them. But I can't say that any of the systems addresses every possible disability and or addresses every disability that allows a voter to vote privately and independently. The independently is probably the biggest thing because, as we've noted in our tests with some of our voters, they do need assistance in explaining how the machine works, sometimes in inserting the ballot, because if they're visually impaired, they can't see it. So they do need some assistance up front and maybe towards the back end, but they can vote independently, and that's the most important thing.
Great. And one final question. You mentioned the need to potentially dispose of existing equipment. Any thoughts on how that might occur?
Well, I've been thinking of eBay, but I'm not sure. there may be people that are interested in it. I haven't actually spoken with our current vendor. I'm sure that they're not going to be thrilled to hear from me that we're buying a new voting system. And by the way, would you like to buy all the voting equipment back that you sold to us 6 years ago? But I'll be looking at other counties to see if they want to supplement their existing inventory. Other states may well be interested in bringing in some of that technology. So we do have several options. We're just not sure exactly what they are right now.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Robit.
Thank you. What do you anticipate the life expectancy of a voting system? Since we've gone through two changes, I know.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because when we purchased the Diebold optical scan, we'd been using the data vote for like 23 years, but that's a ballot punch. I mean, it has no technology involved. It has got no operating system. They say that, you know, these systems can last 10 to 15 years. The real issue that remains out there, we've got this one-time funding. This is not going to happen again, and we are going to be faced with that issue somewhere down the line of having to upgrade whatever system we get, no matter which one it is. You're bringing in two pieces of technology or up to five pieces of technology at a voting poll, and that is going to be an issue 10, 15 years out.
The only reason I brought it up is because one of those options you had a $400,000 cost, and if you got 10 years, you could have paid it back by the cost, the reduction in...
Terms of eliminating the ballot?
Yeah.
Right.
But since none of them are certified by the state, we can't buy them.
Right. That does cause a problem in signing the contract. That actually saves us about $45,000 per election, so you're figuring...
You have a 10-year payback.
About $100,000 every other year, because we only have elections in the... Mm-hmm. Well, normally we only have elections in the even-numbered years. And so it would, and that's the cost of that system is like $3.3 million. So the payback would be much more than that.
The other thing is, in buying the current system we have now, this is kind of a twofold question. Does any of the HAVA money allow you to set aside funds for trust for maintenance, or can you then buy a extended maintenance agreements on these things that would reduce your long-term maintenance cost on?
We have not gotten the exact language of what the state is going to allow us to use the HAVA money for, but our understanding is that it will only be able to be used for one-time costs, meaning that you can't pay for future costs, you know, pull that money and pay for those future costs with the HAVA money. It has to be paid for one-time costs. Voter education, the system purchase, warehouse modifications can be paid out of those HAVA funds, a voter education program, those sorts of things.
You could buy a maintenance agreement, though.
We can buy a maintenance, but normally, and I can research it, but normally how they do it, it's a yearly maintenance that you pay every year as an ongoing cost. You don't pay, you don't buy a five-year extended contract. Yeah. But that is something that we can pursue with.
It would seem like if you could get the funds, and since we're going to have excess funds over what our cost factor
right.
is to do that.
Right. Now, the VMB money cannot be used for that. It's very specific. It can only be used for the hardware and software, but we will have money from the HAVA that we should have some money that we can at least pursue looking into that.
Okay. I have no other questions, so I have one.
Yes.
Yeah, I assume that with the system that provides the paper trail, that pretty much eliminates the danger of hacking into our system from someplace else and changing the tally?
Yes, in our mind it does.
I'm just a suspicious person.
I know. You know, a lot of people still continue to question any use of the voting systems that are out on the market these days. But with voting systems, it's important to note that it's all the components that go into the election preparation, the pre-election testing. Our central computers are not attached to any to the internet or to any other computers in the county. They're completely standalone. The only access to them is when results are modemed to us for the 30 seconds on election night that it takes to modem results to us. We have ways of testing to make sure that the vote totals that we got from the polls are the same, that the vote totals that they sent are the same as the ones that we received. And then the post-election certification, all of that wraps together to ensure the integrity of the election. It does remove the question of how do I know when I press a touch screen of vote choice on a touch screen that is really how my ballot's being cast. The voters are clearly marked their ballot, and that eliminates that voter verification.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Do we need to give an attaboy?
I have two requests to speak forms.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Before we have the request to speak to, very much neglected to introduce one of my staff that's here that was instrumental in helping with this report. Sitting in the front row is Tommy Gong, who's the assistant clerk recorder. Been with us since the end of June, and I kind of like threw him into all of this turmoil that our office is going through with special elections. So he's been very instrumental in helping us prepare this report, and I apologize for not introducing him earlier.
And do you wish to say anything?
Okay. Didn't mean to put him on the spot like that.
Okay, with that, I have two requests. I'll open it to the public. Two requests to speak forms, Mark Phillips, followed by Eric Greening. They could step to the microphones.
Good morning.
Excuse me.
I gave a more complete document that you can read through. I'm only going to be able to hit the highlights here. In September of 2003, I became interested in voting machines, and I first contacted Julie at that time and began asking her a whole slew of questions, some of them several times. And I have to say that Julie has been extremely generous with her time and her patience in dealing with these questions. She's been very prompt in getting back to me with any questions that I've had, and I wanted to thank her for that. She's been great to work with. At the same time, I got together with some other folks, and we formed a committee called the San Luis Obispo Citizens for Open Voting, and we started looking at the technology involved in voting machines and the good, the bad, and the ugly. And we've looked at this very, very hard. I've been to Sacramento to talk to the Voting Systems and Procedures Panel. I'm in contact with people from outside our area. There's a lot of activists involved in this. And our observation of what Julie is proposing here is that we're in complete support of what she's doing. There isn't a perfect answer out there that's been certified yet. I agree with Julie on that. There could be. There's some actually not too far away, but right now, today, it's not there. So I've looked at the other possibilities, and the AutoMark system is, I think, head and shoulders above the rest. And I'm a pretty skeptical guy. I'm at least as questioning of the technology as Shirley is, and I think this is probably the best system we can get. I will mention There is another option called, it's being put out by the Open Voting Consortium, and they demonstrated a prototype to this to the San Jose Mercury News in April of last year. Let me just read what the San Jose Mercury News said about it. An electronic voting system that's cheap, secure, accurate, and easy to use. One that uses off-the-shelf hardware and publicly examinable software. One that voters can trust. A prototype of such a system, the holy grail of election officials, was on display last week in San Jose. It looked like the real deal. The only problem with this system is it's not been approved yet. They think it's going to take about $1 million to accomplish that. That's not going to happen before the end of the year. So we have to wait for a system like this. But they can exist. And another thing about this Open Voting Consortium is that they're a not-for-profit group. Turning our voting over to a profit-driven corporation is very unsettling to several of us, even if they don't have a political agenda. And as I'm sure you've heard, some of these do have a political agenda. We would only make two comments about the proposal that Julie...
I'm sorry, your time is up.
Goes awfully fast. Well, they're in the
letter. It does go fast. yes, Eric.
I'm Eric Greening, and I also agree with the staff recommendation and with option two, and I think you've had a good discussion about it here. The key that overrides all other advantages and disadvantages presented to all of the options that are in front of you on page 6, option 2, advantage 5, quote, the automark clearly captures voter intent on a paper ballot, unquote. If we can't have a meaningful recount, we don't have an election the public can trust. If we don't have an election the public can trust, we're not likely to have robust, involved voter participation. But as long as the voters can trust the outcome, even if it takes a while to find out what it is in a close election, where there is a hand count, and that hand count can be recounted in front of witnesses from different sides of an issue, as long as we have that, we have an election that we know belongs to the people. Obviously, there are some things that would be desirable, and I agree with Julie and with Mark that there may be a more perfect system at some time. Privacy and confidentiality are important. I should note, however, that not only the disabled community, but also those who are not literate already grapple with this. People who are not literate have the right to and do take literate people with them into the polling place, and so obviously they lack privacy in marking their ballots. I'm not saying that makes it all right for disabled people who wish they had privacy, but I'm saying that universally we don't yet have privacy. I don't know if a system can be designed for illiterate people to have privacy. Perhaps it's being worked on, but more important than anything else is accuracy and the public knowing that when the votes are counted, it is the will of the people that's being counted and not a glitch. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Eric.
If I can just address
yes, please.
Mr. Green's comments. The audio capability of the automark does allow an illiterate voter to vote independently and privately because they can listen to the ballot with the audio component, so and then use the touchscreen to cast their ballot.
Another plus. Thank you.
Okay. With that, this is a receive and file. So all we need is a voice vote.
That's it.
Move to receive and file.
Second.
I made the comment by giving the attaboy. I mean, that was good, but you don't need our direction then to go ahead with the automark.
No, unless you want to.
I was thinking maybe
to disagree with my.
We could do that.
And then
that.
We can arm wrestle.
I was actually going to say to give the board a vote of confidence to go ahead with the ESS and automark system.
ESS and automark.
ESS, and that would be the motion I would make as well as receive and file.
And Mr. Asajian wishes to second that.
I'd like to make it.
Would you like to say that verbally for the record?
Second.
Okay. Mr. Patterson, for discussion?
Yeah. Thank you, quickly. Madam Chair. I just wanted to quickly comment. I want to thank Mark Phillips for his efforts and others in the community that have worked to ensure that we do the best possible process in voting in San Luis Obispo County. And Julie, I really appreciate your efforts, and not just now with this item, but from feedback from others that I've gotten, you've always been open and willing to help people with election issues, and I appreciate your office being willing to take that on. And again, Mark, thank you and your group for pursuing this, and Julie, thank you for working with all concerned and making sure that our voting system is as open and available and accurate as humanly possible. Thank you.
Thank you.
We've had a motion and a second. May we have a roll call, please?
Mr. Ovitt?
Aye.
Mr. Asajian?
Aye.
Mr. Linthal?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Ms. Bianchi?
Yes. So thank you very much. Thank you, thank you, thank you. With that, our morning session is concluded. No, it isn't either. We are going to go into closed session in 15 minutes. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to address the board on any closed session item? Seeing none, we will go into closed session and return at 2 o'clock. Thank you. Okay, may we have, I guess, did anybody hear that? Well, that's too bad if they didn't. May we have a report out of closed session, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The board met in closed session this morning and discussed the items listed on the agenda. The board took action on one item in the litigation, Santa Maria Water Conservation District versus the City of Santa Maria. The board unanimously approved an amended stipulated settlement. We also discussed in closed session the fact that a quiet title action, Bold versus the county, which concerned property in Oceano, was dismissed by the plaintiff, and that litigation has ended. And that concludes the report for today.
Thank you very much. That's unusual that we took action. Sort of startling. With that, we have an item to complete from this morning.
Item C1 is back for adoption of the correct resolution now.
You've been given a copy of a resolution that overturns the Planning Commission decision for denial and includes findings and conditions for approval before you today to take action on.
Okay, thank you very much.
Do we have to go back to public on this?
I don't think so, because I don't see any of the public here.
Make a motion. We approve this. We move to approve the adoption of this resolution.
And second.
And that is the resolution reversing the decision of the Planning Commission and conditionally approving the application of Thomas and Dory Zwinger. So people know what we're doing. We do know. That would require a roll call, please.
It sure does. Mr. Shajian?
Aye.
Mr. Linthal?
Aye.
Mr. Ovid?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes. That completes the last item of the morning session. So may we have an introduction of item D1, please?
Item D1 is a presentation of the revisions to the county agricultural buffer policy.
Maybe we have a staff report.
Madam Chair, my mic on?
No, turn the red light off.
Oh, okay. On means off.
No red light, there you go.
Or off means on.
I'll get used to the new place here. Madam Chair, members of the board, my name is Bob Lilly, County Ag Commissioner, and I'll be doing the staff report this afternoon and be available to answer any questions. Also, we have members of the planning staff and the environmental staff here, if you have any questions of them as well. A bit of a background before we get into the PowerPoint presentation. In the mid-80s, the Agriculture Department was receiving project referrals from the planning staff to look at developments that were proposed next to agricultural operations. And we started to recommend agricultural buffers at that point in time as a project mitigation to help allow for the project to be completed and to protect agriculture. And then in 1990, at the Board of Supervisors' request, we established a departmental policy that was adopted by the board at that time to give us the guiding principles and benchmarks in which to provide our buffer recommendations. And then we went on annually with our review of projects since then. And then in 1998, the board adopted the Ag and Open Space element. And as part of that, created Ag Policy Number 17 called Ag Buffers. And also the existing policy of 1990 was a part of the Ag and Open Space element as Appendix D. And one of the parts of the Ag Policy 17 asked for our department to come back and provide revisions to the buffer policy, so we're doing that today. And then with 15 years' experience, we're also updating necessary provisions in that, sort of lessons learned since then. As we usually do, we reviewed the revisions with the planning staff, and then we took them to the Ag Liaison Board, and we had the support of the planning staff and the Ag Liaison Board, and those documents are attached in your packet as well. So that would be the background, so we'll go ahead and start with the presentation. So this is called Agricultural Buffer Policies and Procedures. Go to the next slide. So we thought we might take a minute and go through a little bit of a Buffer 1A class so we're all on the same page as far as what we're talking about. And so when we talk about what is a buffer is either distance and or screening to create some separation between an agricultural use and proposed development. And development could be homes or a school or apartments or any place that basically constitute a dwelling or where people will be on site there. So we go to the next slide. So when we talk about a buffer distance, say if we recommend a 300-foot buffer, the 300 feet is the distance, as you can see on this slide, between the edge of the agricultural operation and the edge of the home site. So typically, as you might be aware, with an agricultural operation, there might be a road around the edge of it, so that might be included in the total distance. And so we're looking for that total separation of 300 feet between the two uses. So we'll get in a minute, we'll get into how we figure out the 300 feet, but just wanted to make sure you understood what the distance actually measured. Next. So when your board adopts the buffer, the actual distance then is measured from the property line to the housing, where the housing is going to start. So it's basically a building setback for the housing or the schools. And so that's the distance that would actually be adopted. And if we were going to have it recorded on a deed or transferred to another document, that would be the distance that would actually be written down from the property line itself. Next. So in addition to distance, there's other methods of buffering as well. Basically, screening, different types of screening techniques, fencing, vegetative screening, a row of trees or something like that. Solid walls. Walls are really the only way to buffer for noise effectively. So that's why you see those big solid walls along freeways and that type of thing, because that's the only effective way to buffer for noise. Then natural buffers such as trees or swales or bluffs or those types of things are also considered mitigation methods and part of the buffer calculation. And when these types of methods are incorporated, we can lower the buffer up to a maximum of 100 feet to give credit, so to speak, for these other types of buffering methods. Next. Why are buffers necessary? They're needed to promote and protect agriculture. As you know, agriculture has lots of intensive types of practices, and those might be deemed as nuisances or annoyances to people that move in next door. So it's necessary to create some distance and or screening to for the quality of life of the individuals moving in and to keep agricultural practices going. Secondly, to protect the public's health and safety with the use of ag chemicals and that type of thing, it creates a margin of safety or some elbow room for the agriculturalist to continue with the practices and to provide for public health and safety. And last, we will be providing technical information and recommendations to decision makers such as yourself or the Planning Commission. We also provide reports to city councils and to LAFCO and school districts and others that are planning on building next to agriculture. Next. Buffers reduce land use conflict. That's the main thing that's accomplished by them. So there's a number of impacts to agriculture, potentially, if you dropped in a row of houses on the fence line right next door to an agricultural operation. So, of course, pesticide use is of a concern, so this creates a margin of safety. Pesticide drift is illegal, but the buffer adds an extra margin of safety to protect the public health and safety. Noise is the most common complaint we get about agricultural operations, distance is a good way to help mitigate noise. And you can see the rest of the issues: nighttime lighting, dust, rodent control practices, agricultural burns, and beehives all tend to, we get complaints about these, and buffers help to reduce the conflicting land uses. Next. And so then there's impacts from the development itself on the agricultural operation that need to be addressed through the buffer. We've seen a number of cases where there's been grading, where there's been erosion, a siltation problem that's actually gone onto the agricultural operation, so the buffer can help with that. And we're seeing more of the problem of harborage of disease and pests as we see more houses being built in the agricultural areas. An example of that is many people now want to have a small vineyard in their backyard or a hobby farm type of a thing. And it sounds good when they go to plant the small vineyard, but then they realize how hard it is to take care of. And many times the small vineyard gets abandoned or the pests aren't adequately managed. And so what it leads to is just a harborage of pests and diseases in a backyard that can move over and affect the agricultural operation. So a buffer, some distance, helps to prevent the movement of the diseases and pests. Farmers continually complain about trespass and liability and theft and that type of thing, so it addresses that. And it also helps to address dogs and other pets going over and harassing livestock, those types of activities. So that's what we're trying to accomplish. So basically, it's an effort to create some compatibility between the two land uses. Obviously, it's inevitable we're going to have growth in the county, but we're trying to help coexistence, basically, between the growth and the ongoing agricultural use. So that's kind of the buffer 1A part. So now we'll get into the three areas of revision that are beyond just basically housekeeping changes that we've done. And so these would be revisions to Appendix D of the Ag and Open Space element. So revision number one. We're recommending some changes to the buffer distance ranges. Is the first recommended change. And the reasons for that is, number one, we've had changes in agricultural practices, in fact, some considerable changes since 1990 when this policy was written. An example of that would be the wine grape industry. They used to use things called propane cannons and Zond guns. They were cannons mounted 10, 15 feet up in the air to scare the birds during harvest, and they created all kinds of noise, and so that's why we needed such a large buffer on the vineyards. But now they've changed the practices, and they use netting mostly to deter the birds, so that would be an example of a change to agricultural practices. There's many others. We've, of course, learned a number of lessons and applied the program on the ground, so to speak, since 1990, and some of the changes in the distances are a result of actual experience that we've learned since then. And we've made an attempt for greater consistency and predictability of the buffer distances with these changes. So we can go to the next one. These are actually the footage that's recommended to be changed by crop. So before we get into the changes, just a brief explanation of how we determine the distance. First of all, we look at the type of agricultural use next to the proposed development, and so that kicks us into one of these ranges. So whether it's a vineyard or an orchard, then that would dictate which range we use. And then within that range, we come up with an actual footage recommendation based on a number of site-specific factors. So that might be the prevailing wind, the topography, any sort of natural buffering that might occur within the area, the type and the density of the development, and a number of site-specific factors then staff look at when they go out to the site. And they basically kind of surgically evaluate it and come up with a specific buffer distance recommendation. So as you can see from the chart, the top three categories are basically most of the intensive agricultural crops we have in the county. So from a consistency standpoint, we're recommending they all be at 200 to 600 foot is the range. And the vineyards have been reduced based on mostly on the change in agricultural practices that I mentioned. The orchards, we don't have nearly as much aerial spraying on the orchards as we used to, and that was one of the reasons that was up to 800 feet. And now the pesticide rules are so strict that we regulate a lot of that, too, on the agricultural side of the fence, so that justified a reduced in that buffer. So our recommendation is 200 to 600 feet then for all three of those intensive crops. And the rest of it is basically unchanged. We've added greenhouses as a separate category instead of as a sub-element of wholesale nursery, but the footage is still the same. So that's the distance. We'll go on to the next one. The second revision relates to agricultural clusters. And so this language already exists in the land use ordinance related to cluster projects, minor and major. We can go on to the next slide. Minor and major cluster projects. So basically, for consistency purposes, we're putting the same language that already exists in the ordinance related to clusters into the buffer policy. So basically, that's kind of a housekeeping type of a change. But as far as the implementation of the buffers and cluster projects, I wanted to briefly talk a little bit about that. So we're going through a transition period with these cluster projects to try to get the buffering accomplished. And now this would be the buffering between the homes, which are the 5% of the development, to buffer the 95% open space, which would be the where the agriculture would continue. So the goal of the program is to have the buffer contained within the 5% development envelope to leave the 95% for agricultural use. But as a practical matter, we're going through a transition to accomplish that. And the last one, revision number three, when the ag and open space element was adopted, the ag liaison board had recommended that we need a way to create disclosure for prospective buyers of property where an agricultural buffer might be existing on the property. And so currently there's not an effective way to do that. So we're in conversation with the clerk's office to come up with an effective way, either through having it recorded on a deed or part of the CCNRs or other methods, so we can make sure to have that information disclosed to a prospective buyer of a piece of property where there is an agricultural buffer. So this part, if your board supports it in concept, we would actually be implementing it from here on out as part of an implementation process with a clerk. So last two slides are just a couple pictures. This is the lower Arroyo Grande Valley, and it's just a good aerial photo that shows the agricultural-urban interface and how the two land uses come together and the need for adequate buffering. And the final slide is the infamous Pike and Elm location. You might remember you had 8 or 10 folks from a group called Neighbors at Risk come in to address your board about the pesticide use at this location. And you can see the donut hole type effect of the agricultural use amongst the urban uses there and the difficulty that creates. And I thought it was just a good picture to show the need for buffering to help protect the public health and safety and the agricultural use. With that, that concludes my presentation. I'll be available to answer any questions that you might have.
Yes, Mr. Shajan, followed by Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. One, the policy that's in front of us, when we speak of land use conflicts, and the Park Commission was addressing this issue as well about the trails, equestrian trails, and especially in the areas of Nipomo where we have horse-friendly community. How are you going to address, if we have a policy in place here today, how is it going to impact what they have done on the Parks Commission level where they have shown trails coming through or nearby activities?
Yeah, the buffer policy doesn't address trails. So we might have other concerns as a department.
But I'm not talking about buffer policy. I'm talking about land use conflicts.
Oh, okay.
And you had mentioned pets and other animals. But we do have equestrian activities that could or might impact the operation of the farmland.
Yeah, most of the farmers would prefer fencing on trails to keep the folks riding their horses and walking and riding their bikes off of their property.
Was the Ag Commission or anyone from the department was aware of what Park Commission was discussing in this last couple of months as far as horse trails?
Yeah, yes, we've attended the hearings, and Linda Kennecke of our staff is on the subcommittee to address the trails plan.
And what they're doing is okay with your department?
I would have to consult with her, and it's a work in progress. I couldn't say that.
Because I really want to know before we have a policy in place if that's not addressed as we go forward, because they're going to come in front of us to accept their trails, especially in the community of Nipomo. And I want to know if that's going to create any conflict with what we're going to do here and what's happened there.
Okay.
It's not just the community of Nipomo. The agricultural areas in Cambria kind of came unglued as well. So
it would be interesting to hear from you prior to that coming in front of us.
Okay.
My other question is, when we talk about screening, do we have a definition? In other words, if you have a row of evergreen trees, is that screening, or you need certain thickness that's considered screening? Do we have a definition?
Yeah, we don't actually get into the specifying the type of trees, although the planner or the environmental staff may actually specify the type of trees. But we do review that with them, and we might say something like it's a solid row of evergreen trees that are fast growing or something like that, just to create the effective screen. But we wouldn't specify one tree over another.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Patterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Mr. Lilly, if you could go back, I guess your technology crew could do that. The second or third slide where you had the agricultural, that one. And this is the total buffer distance. And you use the example, Bob, of, say, 300 feet. That would be measured between the structure, the residence, and the actual crop. But then in the next slide, you say when it's actually recorded in the deed, you just go from the property line to the structure. How are you determining the difference? I mean, is that half the total distance, or
it would actually be a calculated measurement at that point in time.
Okay, but I'm just curious to know if, you know, you need a 300-foot buffer total. You're picking up, can the distance between the residence and the crop vary from case to case, and then can that change? In other words, for example, you use 300 feet as a total buffer necessary for public health protection and so forth. Yet when it's recorded, the distance is only from the residence to the property line is 100 feet. And that's what's recorded. What if the cropping activity moves? I mean, you're putting the onus on agriculture to make up that other 200 feet. I mean, how does that work? I'm not clear.
Yeah, we would. It's a little bit of a crystal ball situation, but we do try to look into the future of what types of different crops may come into play. But typically, as you probably know, Jim, there's typically a road, a turnaround road at the end of the rows.
Right.
So that will typically stay there. So that's often what's included in the buffer is just basically the dirt road, which typically doesn't change, even if they change crops, because they still have to turn the equipment around. But yeah, we do. We might even be dealing with a vacant or a fallow field where there's no crop there at all, and recommending a buffer. So staff have to use some of their discretion and judgment to determine where the edge of the crop actually might be in the future.
Okay, and the element of confusion for me here is that when we've dealt with this issue so far this year, it's been relative to new development where people have wanted to go in and construct a home adjacent to agricultural activities. And the buffer was established, but that entire buffer was to be, the setback was actually to be on the property where the residence was being built. Is that correct?
By policy, the buffer is on the developer's property. I went through these two slides to kind of show you how we go about and measure it, but the actual buffer that's finally determined is entirely on the developer's property.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Ovid.
Thanks. Don't lose that picture because Mr. Patterson brought it up, and I have it in my later conversation. I want to talk about this. And the issue here is that it gets confusing. If you're looking at the distance from the crop to the distance of the potential residence, fine. But when we get the recommendation as either an appeal or it's part of the Planning Commission's recommendation, it's going to have to be the distance from the property line because that's what's get recorded and the minutes are what's recorded so that there is no confusion. So in this particular case, let's say here that it's an orchard situation, you might have a 200-foot buffer based on what your site evaluation is, but the recommendation through the environmental process, and that's going to have to say 150 feet or 100 feet from property line so that, you know, it can be understood that that's what we're dealing with. Because to turn around and say, I've got a 300-foot buffer, but I'm only going to record 150 feet can get confusing.
That's a good suggestion, and we can make that change.
And I've got some other changes, but I want to do that after the public comes in and just have a discussion with it then. Thank you.
Okay. I have no other lights, so I will open it to the public. I have two requests to speak forms. First is Eric Greening, and the second is Michael Wynn.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and I'm always nervous about shrinking any buffers that we have specific to the issue of pesticides. What is the science behind these numbers, science-based decision rather than a political decision, and what is the threshold of damage or danger to people, the effects on people that constitute a problem in the minds of staff and once you act in the minds of your board? In other words, pesticide exposure can lead to damage, deleterious effects, everything ranging from an acute asthma attack leading to death down to subclinical effects that are not generally measured medically, such as in the study done in Sonora, Mexico, where members of the same family, cousins, first cousins, some of whom were the country cousins living out in the pristine mountain areas and some of whom were living exposed to pesticides living next to the cultivated fields, were showing tremendous developmental differences in terms of motor skills, schoolwork, and so on, but they were not being measured as being different medically. So there's all sorts of thresholds. What threshold do we consider significant in terms of risk to people? And how have these distances been arrived at in relation to these thresholds? A couple of issues, too. Cacho mentioned vegetative screening in a definition. We certainly do need more a refinement on that. You can get a permanent number attached to a parcel based on something quite transitory, namely the growth or death or disease or removal of vegetation. How do we know that vegetative screening will remain? And if it's promised to be at a certain height but takes a while to establish, at what point do you measure those effects? On the issue of trails, actually most of the discussion in front of Parks and Rec had to do with public rights of way that already exist rather than condemning anyone's land. And it should be mentioned that toxins are used on public rights of way as well. It's not just an agricultural issue. And so it needs to be looked at separately from agriculture, what are we exposing our population, and particularly our walking, bicycling, and equestrian population to? There are increasing tendencies toward, by those who are forward-looking, toward toxin-free maintenance of such rights of way. I notice Caltrans has promised to do so in relation to Highway 166. That came out of one of the Council of Governments projects that was discussed there. So this is, there is a broader context, but I'd like to see a science-based decision rather than a political numbers juggling. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't shrink any numbers until we see the science. Thank you.
Michael Wynn, followed by Karen Mansfield.
My name is Michael Wynn. I'm from Napomo. I live across the street from dryland farming and downwind, at least some of the year, from citrus, so I have some interest in this. Having farmed myself and having had a pesticide applicator's license and used it in this county, I've always been concerned that these buffers protect the farmer from various kinds of litigation that can arise from science that's either misunderstood or things that people are fearful of. I would encourage you not to decrease the minimums on the two sets of permanent crops that you have listed here, both the vineyards and irrigated orchards can have various uses that people worry about a lot. And I used to spray next to school in Avila, and I know there were constant phone calls, and I actually put a little windsock up so that people could see which way the wind was blowing. Because it isn't just the structure that people worry about. It's playground equipment. It's things that people play with in their backyards. It's auxiliary buildings that play houses and other such things that are not regularly slept in. So I would encourage you to do as Mr. Ovid said, to use the property line. And don't just look at the primary dwelling as your distance, but either prohibit any building of structures in the buffer area or set it back so that it's to the nearest structure. I think that's a much better saving, and frankly, it just gets rid of a lot of litigation that otherwise we'll have to deal with. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Karen Mansfield.
Good afternoon. Karen Mansfield with the San Luis Obispo County Agricultural Task Force. I need to preface my comments. Our board has not met for a couple of months. We've been on a little bit of a break, so we have not officially discussed this issue as well as the trails. But because Supervisor Asajian brought up the issue of the trails, I just wanted to mention to you that I've gone to all the Parks and Recs Commission hearings, and there are a lot of concerns with respect to the proposed trails on the part of agriculture. I just wanted you to be aware of that. It's going to be discussed at our board when we do meet in September, but there are a lot of concerns. And keep in mind to protect agriculture, and the concerns are about the compatibility of the trail uses with the adjacent agricultural practices. And I have a different interpretation than Eric. I think the proposed trails in the list of their wish list aren't just on public right-of-ways. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. I have no other requests to speak forms, so I'll bring it back, close it to the public, and bring it back to the board. And I have another light up here, but I want to make a comment relative to trails, and then we'll get off of trails and get back to buffers. But most of the trail proponents are really good, responsible people, and they stay on the trails. They don't hop over the fence and steal the oranges in the orchard, or they don't actually think of them as stealing. You know, they have... That farmer has so many, he's not going to miss one or two. Well, you get 400 or 500 people doing that, each taking one or two, and you've lost quite a... This happened to a cousin of mine in San Fernando Valley in the olden days. So you really... Most of the trail proponents would be fine. It's the other irresponsible trail users that are not fine. Having chased some off of my property and... as recently as 2 years ago. So I understand the problem. With that, we'll get back to buffers. Mr. Ovid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to go through this. I've got a lot of recommendations, and I did have a conversation with Bob Lilly on many of these yesterday, so hopefully we can respond to them. Some of them are grammatical, some of them are of different types of how it affects land. And again, like Bob, I was part of the crew that basically put this together when it started, and we've seen things happen over the years that have given me the tools for where I come from. The first major question I have, and it's a nemesis that I have all the time, and it's referred to value relative words and how they're interpreted and how they're looked at. And the first issue that I have, and Bob and I talked about it, and he said, well, we have to do this for CEQA, but the first paragraph on, or the last paragraph on the bottom of page D14 reads across there, will evaluate referrals to determine if potential significant land use conflict between ag. My problem is when you use the term potential significant, it has a separate connotation by itself. And the substitution I put on here, because this is what the Agriculture Commissioner is determining, is there a land use conflict? Not whether it's how, and in that determination is how significant. And then on top of that, they're making a recommendation that brings it down below the level of significance. So when my recommendation on this first paragraph is to strike out potential significant and just put the word A. So it refers referrals to determine a land use conflict, and that's what they are doing. And I don't know what the board's saying on this, and I know you were going to try and talk to John Nall, and John's here. I think it clarifies it because, in my opinion, the Agriculture Commissioner is evaluating this conflict, and then we'll determine if it is going to be significant or not, and then makes the mitigation recommendation to us, the board, or the Planning Commission.
You know, what I thought about is we can do is determine if potential land use conflict exists, and in parentheses you can say
significant out. Significant is a driving
less significant
word.
Or no, yeah. Significant. That's something to be determined.
I think we better have John comment on that.
John and I haven't had a chance to talk on this, but Bob and I did yesterday.
Madam Chair, members of the board, I'm John Nall. I'm your principal environmental specialist with the Planning Department. Ultimately, the decision about whether or not an issue like this is significant or not lies with your planning staff, lots of times specifically with your with the environmental division. However, we rely as planning staff on the expertise of the Ag Commissioner's Office. These folks in the Ag Commissioner's Office have the expertise in the area of agricultural resources. That's, I think, probably why you hired them. We rely on that expertise in order then to fashion mitigation measures and then ultimately require those as conditions of approval. My take on the language is it's fine the way it is. I don't think that changing it the way your board is discussing at this point would necessarily make it incorrect. But my point is that we do rely on the Ag Commissioner's expertise in order to then formulate our mitigation measures.
And even though I have another light, I want to break in here if I could. And so it's a combination of your department and the Ag Commissioner's Office that determines the meaning of the word significant.
That is correct.
And so it's, you know, any word, in my view, and I'll be flip, including the word is, has, you know, some subjective potential for misinterpretation. I mean, almost any word that you can think of. So I don't mind this language because I don't see it as vague, perhaps, as someone else, like Mr. Ovid.
My point at this particular thing is that not until it gets to the environmental is it determined whether it's significant or not. But the job of the referring department at this particular time is to see if there is a land use conflict. And then they make recommendation of what those modifications are. And the word significant has a different meaning to the environmental people in terms of how you mitigate this thing or not. And that's the problem I have. And what I have to say is I'm not looking at just this sentence. I look at the whole document and what its reference is. And I believe that Cacho, in a term, take out the word significant and potential land use conflict, is what we're talking about. And, well, and it's not significant until it's determined or until it's looked at by the Ag Department. And how significant it is what the buffers are set up for. And that's, well, my issue.
But there could be a, you know, a minor conflict that's easily resolved so that it's not, doesn't rise to the level of significant.
But
and,
in a sense,
and if the, yeah, if the environment, if the environmental office is working in concert with the Ag Commissioner's office, then and the definition of the word significant is determined at that point.
That's fine. The problem that here, when you put it here, it already designates it as an environmental issue before it's been determined.
Not necessarily, because it says potential. There may not be a potential.
But if I go back up to number three above, where it says they are providing the
semantics.
Board of Supervisors and these other technical information assistance and buffer recommendations to address land use compatibility and issues, we haven't found it guilty yet. And that's my whole issue, is this particular word significant in the terms of what the agriculture commissioner is looking at, and what his response to me was, well, it's the environmental people that want that language in there. Well, it's not necessary.
If I might respond to that, Supervisor Ovitt, you're right about the connotation that when the Ag Commissioner's office calls it out as significant, that does imply that mitigation is necessary. That's correct. And the Ag Commissioner's office knows that, and planning staff knows that, so we're on the same page as far as the definition of significant impact on the environment goes. But what I wanted to say was that that's the point here, is that whenever we refer a project to an agency for consideration of their expertise on a certain issue area, in this case agricultural resources, we are trying to solicit whether or not they think that it is going to be a significant impact on the environment. We do the same thing with environmental health, air pollution control district, public works. We are interested in their input as to whether or not, given their expertise in that issue area, they believe that it is a significant impact on the environment.
And the only argument that I have on that is that when it comes out as a report, the issue in this particular case would be that it is a environmental issue that has been mitigated to less than significant because the buffers have been applied. It does not qualify as a significant. I have the same issue with air pollution control, because they call it a significant issue, and the only recommendation they make on a construction project is come out and detune the tractors while they're working. And it makes it less than significant. Yeah. But the connotation ahead of the schedule is like it's saying you're guilty before you started.
And Mr. Patterson
and
is
all
next.
I wanted to ask here is if the board would just take out the word significant and use potential land use conflict.
Let me address that, if I may. Doesn't removing the word significant actually lower the threshold at which a potential conflict would be determined?
You may have a project.
I mean, I think if it's not there, any conflict.
That you could argue that if you don't call it out as significant, then planning staff will not be alerted to the fact that mitigation need be applied.
But
there is that argument.
This is half glass, half full, half empty stuff, and I think it's ridiculous, because what staff is telling you, the referral, Fish and Game, all of them tell you that here's the issue, here's the mitigation, it will take it less than significant.
Okay,
but it's not significant when they give it to you.
Well, generally what they do is they say that in the response to the referral, the agency will say, this has the potential to be a significant impact. However, if you apply this mitigation, the impact is mitigated to a level of insignificance.
Right.
That's typically how it works.
But okay. My argument is take the word significant out and let that be.
No, Mr. Lilly wants to say something.
Yeah.
So the way we use it operationally is if, in some projects, we determine that there's no impact, or the impact is less than significant. And we use the word significant as a trigger so the buffer is implemented, is basically how we use it operationally. Because some projects might not need a buffer or might have adequate buffering as it is, so we would say there's no impact or it's less than significant.
Madam Chair, if I might clarify answers to two other questions that came up previously. One was from Cacho, and that is having to do with the vegetative screen. We have crafted in the department standard language that we use for that vegetative screen, and it requires both trees and understory in order to create a fairly solid barrier from top to bottom that will actually physically act as a noise barrier screen against the kinds of conflicts that we're trying to screen out, if you will.
Should that be then specified in this policy? Is where we talk about screening spelled out?
There is a thing in the back that says that they will not determine screening.
I think it should be on a case-by-case basis.
And it is. And each time a project is considered with a screen, obviously that condition's in there, and the decision-making body can alter that condition or whatever.
Yeah, from my experience, most of these are determined on a case-by-case basis because if you have, you know, one kind of screening in my area might not work at all in Creston, you know, or Shandon.
Right.
So you have to have it on a case by case.
They always show the pictures of Roy Grandy. They never show the rest of the world, you know.
Well, in my opinion, I don't know, you know, I'm not an expert, but it would seem to me you wouldn't want to use vegetative screening to prevent pesticide drift because it could drift right through the vegetation, but it might be adequate for, say, dust.
Where I was coming from, where applicable, what is our understanding? So that if a site can use screening, then what is an acceptable screening for the type of use, and it's all spelled out. But I'm not going to make an issue out of it.
Anyway, Madam Chair, if I might, I just brought that up to take the word significant out. It still does not diminish what this buffer policy about.
I don't want to take
about
the word significant out.
And I know Kacha said take it out and use potential. And that's the request I have there.
Well,
the other clarification, Madam Chair, if I might make, was Supervisor Obit had brought up the measure, where we measure from for the buffer. And
well, I want to get to that later. It's on in here later on.
Well, just to say that we go from the property line to the proposed residence or building envelope or control line that gets established to indicate that buffer on the residential piece. We do take that from the property line. That's how the mitigation shows up in the developer's statement and eventually shows up in the condition of approval. Just wanted to add that clarification.
Yeah, and I want to, not, you can sit down if you like, John. I always watch a program on Friday night called Now, and it's on PBS, and it generally is on issues of current interest. And of interest the other night was pesticide drift between agricultural areas and housing developments. And oddly enough, they used housing developments on the Oxnard Plain in Ventura County, and they used the interface between urban and rural in Fresno County. And I thought, oh, isn't that convenient? But I think taking out the word significant just really takes away a good trigger. And it may not eventually be significant, and by leaving the word potentially significant, you're not guilty until, you know, proven innocent. You're just saying this is something that may be a problem and we need to address it.
Yeah, and I think it keeps it consistent with the other language throughout the environmental determination. So when you read the entire sentence, we'll evaluate referrals to determine if potential significant land use conflicts between ag, et cetera. It makes sense in that context, and it does keep it consistent with the other wording. And so I don't really have a problem with it.
As I say, I mentioned it because we've learned over the time period that everybody's going to build next to ag knows there's going to be a buffer. And as Mr. Lilly said, in some cases it's not a significant issue because there is distance. In other cases, it could be. And so I'm just going to ask the board. If they want to change it, fine. If you don't, that's all I'm asking. Take that word out at that point. And I haven't heard anybody else say yes or no, whether Kacha or...
Oh, I said no. We'll get to that when we finish the...
Well, because I have...
Are there any other issues that
yes,
anyone...
Yes, I have. And a lot of them are value relative words, but when you get on to, a grammatical one, I always love it when I find a grammatical, because I'm not anywhere close to being that. But on the next page, item 1C, when they took out the area, they put they took the and out and didn't put an A back in there. So it should read pesticides use
which one?
As
where are you?
A tool for agriculture.
Where are you?
C, item C.
Helps maintain D15, right? Page D15.
D15, number 1C.
Should we use as a tool for agriculture, correct?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that one's good.
Okay, then on page D16, referral process number two. It says an on-site evaluation may be conducted. I need to change that to shall be conducted, because it doesn't need to have a windshield to look at it. It needs somebody to actually go out and look at it to determine whether these things are, you know, what kind of conflict we have. And if they don't go out and look at it, I don't know how they can stand up and defend it.
Okay, that's good.
And I have the same issue with number three and potential significant. You know, it's how it's used. You know, we're evaluating a land use conflict is what we're in. You know, we have not yet determined whether it is significant or not. And that's my only argument. And if we're going to change it, we need to change it all the way through this thing. And then number five just has a bunch of value relative words that I think need to be defined. What is margin of safety? You know, what is adequately? And then again, we use the term significance. It says below a level of significance. And again, this is conflict of that word throughout this whole document. And again, it goes over on the next page, D17. And it says the proposals are the most significant factors. Now, this can be understood because we're talking about an adjective now, and how it's being used in the determinant of a significant or use conflict. Again, we don't define what significant is. And so, again, we have this whole thing to this document of that term. But the other one I think needs to have an answer to it is in the same page, D17 on 2B. They refer to any other than agriculture, which is open space, rural land zoning, and I put down, why don't we have rural residential? Because you talk about greenhouses and other things else, and a vast majority of our small ag operations are in rural residential lands. So if you're going to have development come up next to a rural residential land that's got an orchard or he's got something going in there in 10 and 12 acres, why are we not looking at that?
You lost me on that one. What
well,
page?
If you look at, in the parentheses, anything other than agriculture, open space, or rural lands.
Oh, so you want to put rural lands or rural residential zoning?
If I'm reading it the way I read it, are you referring to that this is the lands we're looking at where agriculture operations may be? And I just want to think that rural residential should be in there specifically, because if you go to Napomo, where most of rural residential land has greenhouses on it.
Okay.
And it's just something that I think just needs to be looked at. Skip that one because it doesn't make any difference one way or the other. But again, on page D18, we get into that sentence about the distance thing, and it needs to be consistent whichever way you're going to do it. If your report and your recommendations from Environmental or Planning Commission, it should be consistent as whether it's going to be from property line, so that there's no confusion. I'm sorry, it's on scope. And that's a buffer is placed on developer's property and will be recorded as a distance from the property line to the building site. And the only confusion came was when you made your presentation. That's true. In some cases, you do have a road or you do have some other things, and that's taken into consideration, the distance from property line maybe. But I think it needs to be, whenever it's reported, however it's reported, just consistent. I think that's what Jim Patterson was talking about too. Mm-hmm. So there's no confusion in what we're talking about.
Does that complete your comments?
No. I got a few more pages. On D19 is C. So Department of Land Use reports will identify recommended mitigation measures and will not provide alternatives. Yet in another portion of this thing, they are talking about that it would cause for a potential to reduce or eliminate some kind of development. And I think if you're going to have that much on one side, you should have the other side to make recommendations for alternatives. And I think that goes
you
to
you
what,
have
what,
to you have to explain that to me again.
Well, what they're saying in here is they're going to recommend mitigation majors. And on a page, and forgive me, but it's in the same area. They have a they have a statement that says that they're not going that that they could make recommendations that would cause for the reduction in the size of the development, which is possible. I mean, I'm not debating that.
Well, what does that have to do with recommended mitigation measures?
If you're going to do that, such as what we get, that what are the alternatives you have? You can have the house where it's at. You can move it in closer if you have an alternative of buffering of some kind or whatever. And these are what recommendations end up coming to us in the planning department or in front of the board. So I'm just wanting to say, I think they can provide alternatives as recommendations. They're not final because the planning commission or LAFCO or the board of supervisors is final. So I just want to take that portion of the sentence out. It's just something over time I think they can do. The development land use reports will identify recommended mitigation measures.
Are you objecting to not providing alternatives?
It says they will not.
Provide?
No, I think
wait
till
I finish talking, because then you don't know what I'm saying. Are you saying that they will not provide alternatives or that they should provide alternatives?
This says that they will not. I think they should. Or they could.
Yeah. Well, isn't that the business of our land use? Mr. Lilly, you're so patient.
I'd be happy to respond to these collectively or as you go, however you'd like, to Harry's comments.
Yeah. I got to find that one.
You want me to take this one now?
Yes, please.
I could comment on the other ones, too, if you like. The reason we put this in is that typically we get a project and we say 300-foot buffer and we give it back to the applicant. And it affects the design of how they wanted to put the houses in, for example. And so then they'll come back and they say, well, what can we do? So they basically ask us to redesign the project for them so we can fit the buffer in. And the board has given us direction over the years that they didn't really want us to get into that business of negotiating the project and redesigning the project. And so that's why we put this statement in there. Maybe it doesn't clarify that as well as it could.
So it should be between the applicant and the planning department.
Or through the hearing process.
Yes.
Yeah, and I don't have a problem with the fact about negotiating what they can do. But telling them that they, and we talked about this yesterday, and the issue is that you can, without changing the design of the project, make some recommendations for alternates. We do that when you look at the environmental documents. There's no project, full project, half project. I'm just saying is that without negotiating or rechanging the project, you could make alternatives. And by leaving that statement out there, it does. But it is true. I mean, and I'm one of them that says quit negotiating the redesign of the project. I don't think we should go that far.
Well, I don't think it's up to the Ag Commissioner's office to redesign the project.
Yeah.
I don't think they want to do that either.
Inconsistency.
I'm seeing Mr. Lilly nod his head up and down. He doesn't want to do that either.
That's fine, because the inconsistency is, however, with certain types of production, agriculture crops, use on agricultural zone land, the analysis may lead to a recommendation to reduce the number of development units, deny a portion or all of the project, or redesign the project to mitigate the impact.
Now, where are you?
That's on page D110, which is over on buffers and development potential. So in one sense, we're saying we don't want to make a recommendation for alternatives. On the other ones, they're saying we're going to make recommendations that may reduce or alter the project. And I think there has to be a consistency. That's the only thing I'm saying. So, you know.
Well, wouldn't that be in the cooperation between the Ag Commissioner's office and the planning staff, the environmental coordinator's office?
It's open. That's all I'm saying. And this, again, this experience. This is what we've talked about over the 10 years we've had this, that what has happened in other cases is that the Ag Department has tried to negotiate or redesign a project based on whatever the issues are. It's not consistent with on the other page. So if you're not going to provide alternatives, then, I don't know how you can do the other one. Or if you're going to do the other one, then you can provide alternatives. But it's not redesigning it. It is providing an alternative that can come forward. So you have an A, B, or C choice when you come forward.
I don't think that's in conflict with the prior page.
That's my interpretation, and that's the problem you interpret.
Well, and the question I have is, if you just left the wording as recommended mitigation measures, there could be several alternatives. Could there not, Bob? As mitigation? I mean, they could do, a buffer with no screening, a buffer with screening. They could relocate. I mean, it seems to me that you could pretty much cover the bases with just your recommended mitigation measures. Is that possible? Well,
yeah, I basically agree with what you said.
Well, I think what Mr. Lilly is intending, and tell me if I'm wrong, that you do not want the Ag Commissioner's office involved in land use planning, in development type land use planning.
That's correct. We'll address the agricultural impacts and provide the buffer recommendation and the screening. Yeah. But if it doesn't fit exactly on the map that was submitted, then we don't feel that we're qualified to redesign the project around the buffer itself. That would be the applicant's job to do that.
And then
the reason we put this, that it might reduce the number of development units, it's kind of a disclosure issue to an applicant, because, of course, they all want the maximum density that they feel they're entitled to under the ordinance, and sometimes the buffer precludes the maximum build-out, and we feel that we want to have that be known ahead of time.
And if they want to go, and I read number 3 on page D110, if the applicant chooses to go to the planning department and redesign the project, they may be able to then come back to you and redo the buffers.
That's correct.
Okay.
Again, this is open-ended, because the last one there, it says redesign the project to mitigating the impacts. At what point are we redesigning it? Are we doing it in the Ag Commissioner's office or out there?
No.
And so if you have, say, I'm not going to provide alternates, then make your recommendation and don't get involved in trying to redesign or denying, whatever. It's just your recommendation. One's got to be one way or the other. And I think when you say what Bob's saying is, we don't want to get in this design thing, and I agree with him, that we have to do something with the language between the two of those, because they conflict each other.
Potential development is determined by the planning department or the environmental coordinator's office. This is number 3 on page 10.
Yeah.
Can you add potential development on the referred land use proposal already designed land use proposal? There needs to be some words in there then that indicate it's planning environmental, not Ag Commissioner.
Well,
I've asked John Nall to come to the microphone.
I want to do one thing while he's coming up. Not to wordsmith, but basically you could take out that first sentence on number 3, and you can say, however, certain types of production, agriculture crops used on agricultural land, the analysis may lead to a recommendation of an altered project. And leave it go at that. And then you're not talking about designing. You're not talking, because it's the recommendation that's talking about it.
Madam Chair, I'm John Nall, planning staff. The planning department doesn't redesign projects either. Your Ag Commissioner doesn't redesign projects. We don't redesign projects. That's the applicant's job. Let me explain.
John,
really,
be careful on that one, because I know you do, because you won't sign a developer's agreement until they change the project.
Well, and that's why I want to explain really how this process works. If the Ag Commissioner has problems with an ag buffer, and it's as a result of, say, a faulty project design, the buffer can't fit, or it takes out too many proposed lots, typically what we do is staff from the Ag Commissioner's office, staff from the planning department, jointly sit down with the applicant and explain what the problem is and talk to them about alternatives. How can we make this project work with the buffer that's being recommended by the Ag Commissioner's office? Then it's up to the applicant to redesign the project, to go back to his engineer, his agent, and redraw the lines of the parcel map or the track map, whatever it is, and bring that back to us for reconsideration. That's how the interaction works between staff and the applicant. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Except that it's like the building inspector say, if you don't paint the house white, I won't sign it off and you won't get your final. So either you paint it white or you don't. And that's what this thing you're talking about. And
I understand
what you're
saying.
The only thing I'm saying in this particular point,
Harry, I agree with that.
Is that it shouldn't be the Ag Department's responsibility. They make their recommendation. It's the developer or the people making the decision as to what they want to do with that buffer. And if they don't like it, then they can appeal it out. But the way the two languages in here are, it's either you are or you aren't.
And my point was that planning staff does not draw the lot lines on the proposed track map or parcel map. That's the applicant's responsibility. We might explain to them that where the lines are drawn as it's proposed don't work because you can't fit a buffer in there, but it's their ultimate responsibility to change that design.
We just had a thing we set in our office the other day. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but I have a problem with this. And it's a problem that's caused issues all along. Mr. Lilly was there, planning department was there, and we were trying to tell this individual, you're not going to do it. But we didn't design the project for him. We gave him some thoughts about what he can do. He chose not to want to do this. He's going to face a denial coming from that department, and he's going to get it from your department. That's his choice. But we didn't design the project for him. We laid out what his alternates are. So either they're going to do it or they're not. But what happens is that and the last time we dealt with this in the Ag Department, it stayed there for a year while they were trying to redesign it. And it shouldn't. It needs to move forward to a point where a decision is made. And that's what I'm saying is that we should tell the Ag Department in this particular, do your analysis, make the recommendation. If you want to do the disclosure, that it, the recommendation can alter the project and move it forward. Get out of this thing of negotiating or redesigning the project. And that's my
right.
problem
and
all along.
I think Ag Commissioner staff and planning staff, certainly, Harry, are well aware of that directive from the board.
Yeah, but as the language writes here, when it says redesign the project to mitigate, it doesn't say the developer is going to do it. It just says is that the analysis led to a recommendation to reduce the number of units, deny a portion or all of the project, redesign the project to mitigate the impacts.
The intent is just to explain what may happen after the buffer recommendation. So maybe we need to say that.
It's going to alter the project.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Right. The
project
may be altered.
Just leave it go at
that because
then you don't have to get into this thing. It takes the pressure off of Bob's people.
May alter the project. The analysis may alter the project.
May lead to a recommendation which will alter the project.
Does that cover the bases, Bob,
okay.
in your mind?
It does.
I'm kind of a believer in disclosure, and so that's why we wanted to put reduce the number of units because people always assume they can get the maximum number of units, and that's not always the case. Maybe we could put it someplace else.
I don't think that should be your debate. I think this is what we find, this is what we need, and then the debate either comes to the planning commissioner to the board. Let us take the brunt of it.
Or it could read, throw this one in, the analysis may lead to recommendations including but not limited to, and then you can include Bob's.
I'm going to say just, it could just change all of the project because if you do that limited to, and I see two attorneys over there, three of them just going crazy because that opens the door is what it really does.
No, I just had a suggestion, perhaps.
Yeah.
What if you simply said, lead to a recommendation which may result in reduction of the number of development units, denial of a portion or all of a proposal, redesign of the project to mitigate impacts of project phasing, but the change would be lead to a recommendation which may result in. Does that make it clear?
Well, grammatically, the first part says the analysis may lead to a recommendation which may.
A recommendation to alter the project.
The simple thing is that it's going to alter the project.
Which may lead to a recommendation.
Which will alter the project. Or which could alter the project.
Which it may result in the things that follow that language, which is what you're intending to say,
well,
isn't it?
Well, what is hard to describe to this bureaucratic society is KISS, keep it simple. And the problem is, I understand what Bob's thing is, but the thing, the more language you put in there, the more you open the door. And you as an attorney, Mr. Lindholm, understand that by opening up the door. So what I'm saying is that what Mr. Lilly's people should be able to do is say, we're going to make a recommendation, and that recommendation may alter your project as you've presented it.
And that's fine. We could leave it at that language. Mr. Lindthal wants to say something.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the interest of being consistent, if we go back to page 6 and 7, since we changed May in referral process number 2, I think it would be appropriate in number 6, where it says Agricultural Commissioner and Land Use Reports may also identify, say, shall identify potential land use conflicts, because that's what we want them to do.
Where were you?
Number 6 on page D17, is it?
Yes. If we took the may out and changed it to shall in number 2 on page 6, I think we should also do that.
Yeah.
On page 7 and number 6, so we're consistent.
Oh, okay.
That's what they're doing anyway, yeah.
Okay, so that we've gotten, at least we've gotten buffers and potential development down to the analysis may lead to a recommendation that may alter the project.
And then leave the other one in about not making.
And leave that one.
Yeah.
Okay, do you have any more after this one?
The only last one that I have is dealing with the ag buffer issue. And again, I'm not sure because it hits two points. It hits on page D111B with the new language at the bottom of that paragraph. And then it also goes over to number 7 on the next page. And I know Katja was in the meeting with me the other day, and what I'm looking at is that when an ag cluster project comes forward, it's the landowner that's basically doing it. It's the land that they're dealing with. And I think instead of just saying that it has to be on the home sites, that it just needs to say that the buffering of the agricultural operation is mandatory. And I don't know how you write it, because what here is it's placing it all on the home sites.
So
what I have seen with the agricultural buffers we've had, I mean, clusters, we've actually had 3 different types, and it's only been 3 that we've had since we've had the cluster deal. There's actually been more clusters, but I'm talking about major land. And what they have done is 3 different operations. One is each landowner is an owner of the property or invested into the operation, which then is like they own the land so they could build their house anywhere in an agricultural place they want. The second kind was where they are not an ownership, but they have a portion of land that is their separate ownership, and you have the agricultural operation. Now, in that particular case, when you have to have 95% what they call open space, or it's agricultural operation, or however it's come up with, there just needs to be in design a buffer. And I don't have an argument with the fact that it's to buffer the agricultural operation. And then the last one we have is, I think, Letitia's, which is basically using all the hillside area, and where their lots are, from where I've looked at it, they're built entirely to stay away from the agricultural operation. So what it does is it kind of ties into why we have the ag cluster, is to give them some flexibility in how they do it. And I'm not arguing about the buffer. It's just how you apply the language that says a buffer must be considered, you know, between the agricultural operation and the development. And I tried to write something, but I don't think it comes out any much better, because I just put ag cluster projects shall include buffers with respect to home sites and the remaining agricultural operation. And then that'd be consistent with number 7, which
If I were writing this, I'd put agricultural use in compliance with the buffer policy.
That's fine. It keeps it so that there's a design flexibility in there, and that's what my concern is.
Are you in number B?
Well, I'm working between 2 of them, because again, to try to keep it consistent all the way through, B is 1, and in there it says agricultural division home sites will be buffered from remaining agricultural zone parts utilizing buffer policy. If I did anything at all there was take out home sites and say ag cluster divisions shall be buffered from the remaining, because the home sites are
Well, the purpose of the buffer is to protect the home sites, and, you know, it's those
No, it's the other way around. It's to protect the agriculture from
the home
site.
No, but it's for public safety, health and safety of the people that live in the homes. So it does serve both purposes, but you have to keep in mind, I think, Harry,
I think you have an argument on that one.
That the, well, you need to maybe read the policy, because it states that, but the point is those properties are individually owned within the cluster, and you need to have the recorded buffer on the property of the home site, so it goes with it.
I just think if you took number 7 and repeated it back under that paragraph, or took that paragraph out, then it makes it consistent.
Well, I think if you put in compliance with the buffer policy, then that makes it consistent, doesn't it? Because we're in compliance with what we're doing with everybody else.
That certainly is just consistent. The way it did, it just didn't feel like it was there, because the thing is you've got 95% open space, and you're going to put it on the 5%, and that's the way Mr. Lilly presented it in the deal. We're saying is that in that 95%, you've got some flexibility to move around. That's all.
I know, but no one is requiring the people to put in a cluster development. And if they choose to put in the cluster development and they choose to put homes in an agricultural area, then they need to comply with the ag buffer policy.
Yeah, I'm comfortable with the wording on 11B, and if we change the wording on number 7 on page 12 to read agricultural use in compliance with the buffer policy, I think that it cleans that up.
What are you doing on number B?
Leaving it as is.
Okay.
12 was the last line in number 7, the remaining agricultural use in compliance with the buffer policy.
The thing that's the difference between the two, and I apologize, in the one on B, you talked about agricultural zone parcels. And then on 7, you're talking about agricultural operations. And it's just a matter of semantics, I guess it is that in the one on B, you can have the zone parcel, and it's still the whole project.
Well, you can put the remaining agricultural land in compliance with the buffer policy.
Or make it operation, agricultural operations, because that's what we're buffering from. It sounds confusing, but what the problem is that when you do an ag cluster, the houses are still in ag zone land.
I understand what you're saying, but the difference between the words use and operation is minimal, so make it agricultural land, and then, of course, and you would need to then make the determination on soil type what crops are likely to be grown. You know, if it's non-irrigated soil type 5, you know you're not going to be raising veg crops.
Are you saying an agricultural use instead of zoned?
No, I say agricultural zone or
use. That's what it says there now.
Well, B says zoned and 7 says use. And it's like I said, it's a semantical deal, but the thing in with these clusters is still in agricultural zone land. The houses are still in the agricultural zone land. They're not separated off by single family or density or other zone. So I guess the best way to do it would be that you just go in there and says on B on page 11 after agricultural, just take out the word zone parcels and put a lot of remaining agricultural uses utilizing the ag buffer policy or the buffer policy. And that's consistent then with number 7.
So you would have what language on B?
On B, it would just read ag cluster division home sites will be buffered from the remaining agricultural uses utilizing the buffer policy. Because I said this the other day, when you talk about use or production and land and zoning, they have three different connotations. They have three different applications. And that's all I have. That was enough.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Patterson.
We had a long conversation on it yesterday. Yeah.
Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like Mr. Lilly to comment on the revised buffer distance range, page D19. Michael Wynn raised the question as to how those ranges were determined and suggested that maybe the minimums don't be reduced, but the maximums could be. And I know, Bob, we talked about it a little bit yesterday, and you explained why the ranges did change. And I think for everyone's interest, could you comment on the fact that maybe the lower, why do we make them closer to, in terms of pesticides, the minimums, in other words?
Yeah, thank you. The original ranges were created in 1990, and for lack of a better way to describe it, I created that from scratch. There was no other policy or information that I could pirate or use from another jurisdiction, and so it was our best estimate at that point in time what the proper ranges should be. And then we've learned from experience, both in applying the buffer and further evaluation of agricultural practices, and that's helped us to provide a justification. There, to go to Eric Greening's comment, there's been significant study on pesticide drift, and so we use that information as well. For a ground application of pesticides, if done properly, small particles may drift between 50 and 100 feet. And for an aerial application, the small particles may drift from 100 to 300 feet. So that data has become available since 1990 when we originally made the proposal. And so and it's kind of a pragmatic, practical issue. It was important to us to have the recommendations be within the range. And so many of our vineyard recommendations, for example, were around 300 feet, and the range didn't even allow for that from being 400 to 800. So as a practical matter, so we could communicate with project applicants what they would expect, we wanted the ranges to reflect what the actual recommendations were going to be and not have our recommendations continually be an exception being below the range.
Are there any other comments? Okay, let's go through these. I think I have most of them identified where Harry had questions.
I'd be happy to comment on them if you like.
Yes.
As we go. I've circled them as well.
I want to keep the language potentially significant, because if I were going to buy a piece of property and someone said to me, you know, you have a potential significant or you have a significant potential for liquefaction on this property, I'd want to know about it. You know, it's not that you're guilty, it's that simply you're warning someone that it may be potentially significant. And I'd want to know that ahead of time. So that's my comment. Go ahead.
I've already provided my comment on that section, so I think it's just up to the board what you would like to do with it at this point in time on this use of the word significant.
Okay. Mr. Lenthal, yes or no?
Significant's fine with me.
Yes?
Yes.
Mr. Shajan?
No.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Okay. It looks like potentially significant stays in, because we know Harry says no.
Where would you get that idea?
Mr. Patterson?
I get to tell you I told you so when it comes back to bite. Never mind.
Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had another question as we're going through this, I wanted to get Mr. Lilly's response to page 6, item 3. The existing agricultural use within an appropriate range is evaluated for potential significant land use conflict with the proposal. And you go on to say that realistic future agricultural uses on agricultural zone parcels may also be considered. And I think it's important to consider future agricultural potential, because we've seen so many changes in agriculture over the course of the last couple of decades that if we make land use decisions, for example, let's say it's land that is laying fallow right now, and it's not being actively irrigated, but it has water potential, irrigation potential, class one or two soils, and it certainly has the potential to be intensified agriculture, but isn't currently being used as agriculture, intensified agriculture. And we evaluated at some lesser value and let development occur that would preclude any intensification of agriculture down the road, I think we're shooting ourselves in the foot. And my question to you is, what would you think of inserting the word shall there so it is something that we look at rather than it be, you know, what triggers when you do it and when you don't? If we leave the word may, then it means you might or might not. When do you do it and when don't you?
I think shall's fine. As a matter of course, we do it anyway. So we'd look at the soil types and the climate and all the agricultural factors, and we do look into the future. So shall would be fine with me.
Okay. I mean, that is something that you could do or that you...
We do. Yes.
Yeah,
oh,
do
well,
anyway.
If you do do it, let's,
do it anyway.
Let's change may to shall then.
Okay.
Okay. And then I want to go back to page D15 on item C and add that word A in, but that's for the clerk, just so we don't forget.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Ovid?
Yeah, I was just going to comment that when you do this potential, we had this conversation yesterday. Again, what we end up doing as a recommendation bases soil type and irrigation. But we never look at the market, and we never look at the economics of planting and maintaining a crop or changing the agricultural potential of a land. And that's where the rub comes in, because to assume that it's going to go to a high-intensity irrigated crop based only on the fact that you might have water in the soil to produce it is not necessarily the key factors. It's just like this morning's ag report. You got all these small guys that are growing melons, and because the inspector couldn't get out there in time, they couldn't sell it to the major markets. They had to go back out and find it. There are other economic reasons why people do not plant higher intensity crops. And that's the rub I have when we get into this. And it's an individual case basis, and we'll bring it up as that. I don't have a problem making the recommendation based on it, but I think you have to look at, you know, what is the history of the land? And then again, what is the economics and what's the market for it? Well, not everybody's going to go out and plant tomatoes, that's for sure.
Okay, and then on, do you want to comment on that, Bob?
So we're on page 6 then?
No. Yeah, that was where he changed to shall. I don't have a problem with
Well, on item 2, we had may change to shall also.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Yeah, the reason we had it at may is that, you know, we have aerial photos now, and in some situations we could make a determination without driving to the site, but the vast majority of the projects we do drive to the site, so that would be fine. So if you'd like shall, that's
well, no, I think the shall on that number 2 has to be, because the thing is an aerial photograph tells you only one thing, what's there, but it doesn't tell you the wind, it doesn't tell you some of the other
land-based
things. That
let's do shall.
And then you want to make that consistent at the top of the next page on number 6?
I don't have a problem with that.
Mr. Lilly, is that okay with you?
Put yes.
Shall there also?
Yes.
And then at the bottom of that page on number B, very last line, open space, rural lands, or rural residential zoning. Is that okay?
That's a good improvement.
Okay. I don't think there are any on the next page unless I missed some.
Well, we have on page 8 under scope. Is that where you're at now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the issue that Supervisor Ovid and Patterson brought up earlier. So it does say that the actual distance is measured and recorded from the property line, and then the second sentence goes on to say that, but the total distance calculation is to the edge of the crop. So that's how we do it, and that's hopefully communicates adequately, but if it doesn't, we can...
That's just a concern.
Yeah.
It gets
out.
So what are you going to do with that?
It's understandable to me, but I'm too close to it, so if it doesn't make any sense to anybody else, it probably needs to be changed. But,
Madam Chair, the only reason I think both of us brought it up is that there is a point of confusion when it comes time at the decision-making, and the decision-making may need to say, you know, and it usually has said, from property line. But a lot of times a letter will or other information will make it from whatever the condition may be, and I think it has to be clear.
Yeah, and to me that isn't clear. I think it says two different things.
Okay, Mr. Hogue, are you going to make a recommendation?
I don't know if you want me to do it now, Warren Hogue, Department of Planning and Building, but I wanted to backtrack to something on page D17, and I'd be happy to do it after you finish the discussion of this particular point.
Okay. Well, go backtrack.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Down at the bottom of D17 on B, you were talking about putting in the parenthetical part of that sentence, residential rural.
Yes.
What that would have the effect of doing is saying that you don't have to apply buffers to houses on 5-acre parcels, because that's what's allowed in residential rural. So do you want to not define 5-acre residential home sites as development, or do you want to define it as development?
The basis of this is there are agricultural operations on rural residentials that can have an effect, and we've had it happen in the Pomo.
That's true.
And it's a notification that should also, you know, and I understand what you're saying is that, which, and these you're saying, because they are rural lands or agriculture, we do not necessarily take a look at it.
Well, see, the difference is really the size of the minimum parcels, because in agriculture, you can't get lower than 20. And in open space, it's much higher than that. In rural lands, you can't get lower than 20. But in residential rural,
okay, we better take that out.
In residential rural lands, the minimum parcel size is 20, but you can have two houses. In residential rural, you can go down to 5 acres, and you could theoretically have a house and a primary dwelling. Yes, there are some agricultural uses that are allowed in residential rural, but it's not required.
But if I have a 5-acre piece and I've got grapes on it and I want to build a house, do I then have to put a buffer in?
Not from your own grapes.
Well,
not from your neighbor, but from your neighbor's grapes.
That's what you're saying with agriculture and rural lands. And what I'm saying is you've got greenhouses, you've got olives, you've got grapes, you've got horse operations, you've got a plethora of agricultural operations on 5 acres and above, and 2.5 acres and above.
Well,
some are a little bit ridiculous. But
what I wanted to draw the board's attention to was the phrase zoned for development. If you don't consider the ag category, the rural lands category, or the open space category zoned for development, do you also want to deliberately decide that residential rural is not considered zoned for development? And I'm just making the point that it does allow a higher density than those other zones.
And the thing is that zoned for development then eliminates clusters in agricultural land, which is development on agricultural land.
No, it doesn't.
I'm not trying to be argumentative. What I'm trying to do is recognize the fact that rural residential has as much significance.
But this is referring to our categories or zones. Ag cluster is an allowed use in the agricultural category, just like cluster divisions are allowed in the rural lands category. What I'm trying to draw the focus to is the intensity of the potential use under the particular land use categories. Residential rural represents a higher intensity of development than the others because of the minimum parcel size that's allowed. That's the point I'm trying to draw your attention to, so that you make a deliberate decision.
Yeah, but I'm looking at the other side of the mirror.
Okay.
Because you know, in the Pomo, you've got, geez, how many greenhouses? You know, Greenheart is all on rural residential land, and they have residencies inside that.
But the buffers will apply to houses. So if you have a
greenhouse. But it's the houses that come up to the agricultural use on the rural residential land.
Buffering the houses on rural residential land from agricultural uses on adjacent properties that may be zoned agriculture, rural lands, or open space. Now, if someone puts in a greenhouse on a residential rural parcel. There's no need to buffer that from adjacent agriculture or rural lands.
But it may provide for a basis for a land use conflict determination only if a production agriculture use exists at the time of evaluation.
Correct.
And those exist on rural residential lands.
Okay. Well, I think I've done the best job I can do in explaining what my
deal.
Point is.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt the flow of your discussion.
Did you want to comment on that?
I was going to address the buffer measurement, from the residential use to either the property line or the crop. And in speaking with Bob just now, we think it would be appropriate to take it from the property line.
Yeah.
That's less confusing than doing it the other way. And it's consistent with the way the mitigation is crafted these days.
So are we going to delete a sentence in that section? It's highlighted.
Just take out the second sentence.
That's what it says now, that the actual distance is recorded from the property line.
Right, but it also goes on to say, however, the total buffer distance calculation
right.
recommendation is measured from the crop. Right.
We'll take that sentence.
Maybe we better get rid of that sentence.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
I think we should. On page 8 in the italicized portion towards the bottom, it starts with however and ends with operation.
Make that go away, Vicki.
She's already deleted it. But we need to go back and find resolution on 7B, I believe. And I think based on what I've heard that maybe we should just leave it as it is and not include rural residential.
I would agree. I hadn't thought it through to the level that Warren had. Appreciate your comments, Warren.
Does that
When you're referring a project next to this type of thing is what it's talking about. And that it is either that or come back and let's change that whole daggum sentence. So basically it says is what we're trying to do is buffer agricultural operations no matter what the land use is.
But yeah, we have many buffers on rural residential parcels, so
yeah,
it's very common.
I know. And it's the only land use that was left out of here because you're making a referral, a project zone for development, that may provide a basis for the conflict determination if production agricultural use exists at the time of evaluation. And then you make the exception for anything other than agriculture, open space, and land use zoning. But rural residential zoning, you have the same conflict.
We might just get rid of the sentence altogether because it creates so much confusion. And the chart on page 11, 10 and 11 addresses it anyway.
So just take out item B?
Since it's such a point of confusion, I've read it probably 8 times, and I'm even confused
myself.
What
if we just take out the parentheses? And it doesn't. What we're talking about is we've got potential conflicts, and just take out the land use zone thing, and then we don't have to worry about rural residential.
Take out the parentheses. Yeah,
yeah,
that's
the parentheses.
Good, yeah.
And leave the word may.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay.
Okay. Very good. And so we've taken out the second sentence on the first paragraph of scope. And I have the next one on page D111 under B. Is that where you have, Bob?
I think there was something on 10.
I have one on page 9.
On 9.
I thought there was something on 10, too.
On number 3 and 10 we talked about.
What's on 9?
No, 9, we didn't change it.
I don't think
we had a discussion under C on 9 about providing alternatives and how that relates to the 3 on the next page.
But then we changed 3, which basically made the disclaimers it may alter the project, and then you don't have to give them alternatives.
So you're comfortable with the way C reads then?
Yes.
Yeah.
On 9?
As long
okay.
as we made the change on 3.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then number 3 on page 10.
We eliminated the first sentence.
No.
The analysis may lead to a recommendation to alter the project.
May lead
then
to a recommendation
the rest of that.
Is that right?
I thought it said may lead to a recommendation that may result in.
Is that okay? All right.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Recommendation may lead to a recommendation to alter the project.
And just leave it at that.
Oh, no.
Period.
No. That may result in.
Yeah, it may result in altering the
may
project.
Lead to a recommendation that may result in, quote,
altering.
Right.
But we say may result in the applicant altering the project.
No.
Oh, come on.
Okay, what's the final language?
Adding at the end there that to recommendation that may result in, and then going on to reduce a number of development units.
No.
Yeah,
no.
Oh, I thought it did.
No.
I thought it was leaving all of that.
No. Shirley basically said to alter the project and then take out the rest of that says reduce the development, deny, and redesign.
So that may alter the project? Is that the
final?
Yeah. May lead to a recommendation to alter the project.
No.
May lead to a recommendation to alter the project.
That may alter the project.
That may lead to a recommendation.
Oh.
To alter the project.
To alter the project.
That's may what I said.
From having to do.
No, there's not anything else.
There's probably some correct words that could be put in, but the idea is, yeah.
And then everything after that is
gone.
So reduce the number of developments, deny a portion, and
that's
redesign
gone.
The project. All that's gone.
Gone.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yes.
And then on D11, on number B, the last sentence, last line, I mean, we took from the remaining agricultural uses utilizing the buffer policy.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll explain the policy implications on this. Basically, what we're talking about is with the cluster, you have a 95% open space piece that's used for agriculture and then a 5% piece that's used for the homes. And the policy question is, where does the buffer go? Does it go in the 5% piece or could it go on the 95% piece? And if you say use the buffer policy, which it's currently is what it says, by policy, the buffer would go on the 5% piece then because
right.
that's the development part.
Right.
So that's the policy implication that we probably should address.
That's fine with me.
We like that.
But and it makes it consistent with number 7. It says basically the same, needed to be buffered from the remaining agricultural uses according to the buffer policy.
In compliance with the buffer policy.
And it just makes it consistent.
Okay, so in compliance with the buffer policy means the buffer goes on the 5% piece.
Right.
Just so we understand what we're doing here.
There will be cases we're going to.
Yeah.
Right.
Because he's making a recommendation,
yeah.
and either us or the Planning Commission are final determinant.
Okay.
So you changed the word zone parcel to uses or
uses,
no?
Uses, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And then number 7 on page 12.
Stayed the same.
The remaining agricultural use in compliance with the buffer policy.
Right. Removing the words according to.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that does it.
Yay.
Got all that, Vicki?
Joe, I
got it.
Are we
move to approve is.
You know, I'm ready, but what I would like to do is have a tentative approval. And look at a clear correction, and hopefully by then we'll also get some input from the Ag Liaison and the Farm Bureau folks.
I think that's
before we get a final.
Okay. So you would like me to take it back to the Ag Liaison, the items that we're changing or we're up discussion?
And also to Farm Bureau.
Okay, and sure, they're part of Ag
Liaison. That's my motion.
Karen?
I'll second.
When is the meeting? So they have them in September? Bring it back 1st of October? Does that work?
No rush. Whenever Mr. Okay. Lilly has accomplished
his goal
as far as corrections and gone through the process of Ag Liaison and Farm Bureau, then he can call in and put it on the agenda.
Well, I was just going to say, if you want to make the motion to tentatively approve and bring it back in October.
Well, I did a tentative motion to bring it back, but I didn't put a date, not knowing when Karen's board and Farm Bureau's board meet. So that's why I'm not shortchanging one organization from the other. But Mr. Lilly can go through it and then find out and call the office and put it on the future agenda.
Well, if we...
Mr. Sazian...
Karen's the one that
says... Karen's with the task force, the Ag Task Force, Ag Liaison, and you're recommending Farm Bureau as well?
Okay, if we have a date certain, then we don't need to re-notify it. If we don't have a date certain, don't we need to re-notify?
I don't think
it's
actually a notice public hearing anyway. It's under board business time, so it's not a noticed public hearing.
Well, it isn't anyway.
No.
Okay.
No.
The only clarification that I can offer you that I know of right now is
Ag Task Force, our meeting is September 7th. I apologize, I don't know when the next Farm Bureau meeting is. An Ag Liaison Board has various meeting dates depending on issues. So Bob may know when their next meeting is.
If notifying public is not a problem, I'd rather have Mr. Okay. Liddy find out the dates and then call in and put it on the future agenda.
Yep. And that would work.
That's my motion, ma'am.
And I second that.
Tentatively make the changes and refer this all back to Ag Task Force, Ag Liaison, and the Farm Bureau, and then bring it back after those meetings.
Yes.
Okay.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Opposed?
Thank you for your patience.
Thank you for your patience.
Thank you for your patience. I received a note with some rather sad news that Tim Mazzucano, our former environmental health officer, has passed away. And so I thought I and the sender of my note here thought it might be appropriate to adjourn in his memory. So we will do that, adjourn in the memory of Tim Mazzucano. With that, we will return on September 13th at 9 a.m.
He was the best.
I know.
Designed by committee.
Yeah.